greatest storyteller in English literature, so I'm always going to love her.
A special selection of documentaries and drama.
250 years of Jane Austen on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Monday the 8th of December. This is Today with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster.
Good morning, the headlines today. Sir Keir Starmer is preparing to welcome President Zelensky to Downing Street for talks with President Macron and Chancellor Merz about a US-backed peace plan. The meeting comes as the Kremlin has welcomed the new US national security strategy, which is sharply critical of Europe. Donald Trump's former ambassador to the EU joins us at 10 past 8.
In Donald Trump's worldview, the United States' interests are furthered by having a more conservative Europe. Period. Full stop.
The government says it plans to create 50,000 new apprenticeships in England as it tries to reverse a fall in those taking up the placements.
Also in today's programme, our international editor Jeremy Bowen reports from Syria a year after the fall of the Assad regime.
They're all bearing marks of where they've been injured by explosions, and also one of them is coughing badly. His lungs have been damaged, I think, by smoke he's inhaled from munitions that they were burning off.
One of the giants of British post-war photography, Martin Parr, has died at the age of 73. His friends Grayson Perry and Wendy Jones will join us to reflect on the power of his work. And
Lando, this is Zach from McLaren. Is this the world champion hotline?
Yeah.
You did it! Thank you. Awesome!
Woo! Thank you, guys. Oh, my God.
That's how it feels to become a Formula One champion. Lando Norris was in tears as he joined the ranks of the greats in Abu Dhabi. Damon Hill is another of the names on that list. We'll talk to him about how it feels to reach the pinnacle of your sport just before 9 o'clock. The BBC News is read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
President Zelensky will be welcomed to Downing Street by Sir Keir Starmer today for talks on the American proposal to end the war between Ukraine and Russia. They'll be joined by the French and German leaders as European powers try to make sure that Kyiv receives security guarantees if there's a ceasefire. Donald Trump has expressed fresh frustration with Mr. Zelensky after days of high-level discussions between the US and Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky said the talks hadn't been easy. Our correspondent Joel Gunter reports from Kyiv.
President Zelensky will be looking to shore up military and security support as he meets Sir Keir Starmer and other European leaders at a pivotal moment for peace talks. Mr. Zelensky's visit follows days of difficult negotiations between Ukraine and the US in Florida, as well as heavy Russian airstrikes in recent nights against Ukrainian infrastructure. And now, just hours ahead of the meeting, criticism from Donald Trump, who accused the Ukrainian leader of failing to read the latest peace plan.
Russia is, I believe, fine with it, but I'm not sure that Zelensky is fine with it. His people love it, but he hasn't read it.
Mr. Trump seems to have been referring to a statement from Mr. Zelensky last night in which he said he was waiting for a full briefing from his negotiating team. In eastern Ukraine, fighting rages around the key city of Pokrovsk, and Russian airstrikes have left residents here facing severe power and heating shortages as they head into the depths of winter.
The head of the Royal Navy is expected to set out today how the UK plans to tackle the Russian threat to undersea cables and pipelines. During the past 2 years, there's been increased activity by ships from Russia operating close to the UK's underwater infrastructure. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
The government says the threat posed by Russia to the UK's underwater infrastructure is real and needs to be confronted. Last month, a suspected Russian spy ship, the Yantar, pointed lasers at RAF pilots tracking its movement close to UK waters. The Navy is developing an initiative known as Atlantic Bastion, a network combining existing ships, submarines and aircraft with a new generation of unmanned vessels and drones. The aim is to identify and confront threats more quickly than before. Skeptics say the Navy lacks the resources to do the job properly.
The Prime Minister is to announce £725 million of funding to create 50,000 new apprenticeships in England. More of them will be in sectors including AI, hospitality and engineering. The government wants to reverse a 40% fall in the number of young people starting apprenticeships over the past decade. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Keir Starmer will visit a McLaren centre today, perhaps hoping some of the team's Formula One success will rub off. The company uses apprenticeships, which the Prime Minister has said he wants treated with the same respect as degree courses. But there has been a sharp decline in young people starting apprenticeships during the last decade. And the nearly 1 million young people out of work, education or training is a big political challenge. The funding, paid for by larger companies and wider taxes, is part of a package aimed at tackling that. The money will cover the cost of some apprenticeships for under 25s in small and medium-sized businesses.
Thailand says its air force has bombed military positions inside Cambodia after armed clashes along their disputed border. A Thai soldier has been killed. This is the most serious confrontation between the two countries since they signed an American-backed ceasefire in July. It ended 5 days of fighting, which killed dozens of soldiers and civilians. From Bangkok, our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports.
Tens of thousands of people in Thailand are once again being moved to temporary shelters as the Thai military reports multiple rockets being fired from the Cambodian side this morning, a weapon which has not been used since a ceasefire was agreed in July. An armed forces spokesman said Thai Air Force jets had bombed Cambodian military positions after a Thai soldier was killed in an exchange of fire on the disputed border. A Cambodian military spokeswoman has accused the Thai army of opening fire first and insisted that the Cambodian government still stood by the peace agreement signed in October in the presence of President Trump.
Nigerian media are reporting that security forces have freed 100 children who were kidnapped from a Catholic boarding school. More than 2 weeks ago, gunmen stormed the school in a remote community in Niger State, abducting more than 300 pupils and 12 members of staff. From Abuja, Medina Maishonu reports.
The abduction of more than 300 children from St. Mary's Catholic boarding school in Niger State was one of the country's worst mass kidnappings. The Christian Association of Nigeria in Niger State and its Commissioner of Police say they've now received confirmation that 100 students have been rescued by security forces. They said the National Security Advisor's Office told them the children would be released in groups to their parents starting from today. It still isn't clear who is behind this kidnapping, which has shone a spotlight on the country's security situation.
The parents of the three girls killed in the Southport attack in July 2024 have told the BBC how they've supported each other to help them through their grief. During interviews for a special documentary, the parents of Alice De Silva Aguirre, Elsie Dot Stancombe and BB King describe how they've set up charitable projects in their children's name. Jenny Stancombe said she established the organisation Elsie's Stories to celebrate her daughter's energy for life.
She just loved to embrace anything she did. We all have the same goal, in a sense, to ensure that our girls aren't remembered for this, that they will live on longer than we do.
You can see Our Girls, the Southport Families, on BBC One at 8 o'clock tomorrow evening.
Thank you, Caroline. It's just coming round to 8 minutes past six now. Let's see what the weather has in store for us today with Simon King. Morning, Simon.
Hi, Anna. Good morning, everybody. Yeah, the weather is going to remain really quite unsettled, especially actually through tomorrow and into Wednesday. We're looking at quite a deep area of low pressure that's going to move in, and that's going to potentially bring some very strong winds, some stormy conditions perhaps for parts of northwest Scotland. So the potential for some damage and some disruption. So stay tuned to the forecast. But for today, well, across southwest England and Wales, we've got a few showers around this morning. Those are clearing quite quickly eastward, actually, and then we'll see some sunny spells developing. But it'll stay quite cloudy in southwest England, and eventually some of that cloud will spread further northward again into Wales, with also some showery rain moving back in across the south, turning a bit breezy, temperatures of 11 to 13 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, a few bright spells through this morning before we see some scattered showers move through. And then we'll see the cloud thicken again later on. And again, there'll be some rain arriving from the south. Temperatures up to about 12 to 14 degrees. So still really quite mild for the time of year. Across northern England, a spell of rain this morning in northwest England, clearing away, and that's going to bring lots of sunny spells. The cloud will start to increase a little bit from the south, highs of 10 to 12 Celsius. And for Northern Ireland today, sunny spells this morning, showers moving in by lunchtime into the early afternoon, highs of 9 to 11. And for Scotland today, some heavy rain in southwest Scotland at the moment. So that's going to move north and east. It will start to break up across northern Scotland around about lunchtime, then sunny spells with showers into the west of Scotland, highs of 7 to 10 Celsius.
Simon, thank you very much indeed. It is now 9 minutes past six. Let's take our first look at the morning papers. The Telegraph says that the leader of Reform UK, Nigel Farage, has been reported to the police because of claims he broke rules on campaign spending. The paper says that Richard Everett, a former Reform councillor who helped Mr Farage to win his seat in Clacton in Essex at the election, submitted the documents to the police. They're said to show that Reform came close to the limit of just over £20,000. But Mr Everett alleges the figure excludes some costs, including leaflets, utility bills and the refurbishment of a bar in the campaign office. He says he believes Mr Farage was blissfully unaware of the omissions, but the Telegraph says that if claims are found to be accurate, he and his election agent could be found personally liable. In response, Reform UK, described Mr Everett as a disgruntled former councillor and denied that any laws have been broken.
The decision to strip Prince Harry of the right to 24-hour armed police protection when he's visiting the UK from his home in America is to be reviewed by the Home Office, according to The Sun this morning. The paper says it could mean a reunion for the King with his grandchildren, Archie and Lilibet, who he hasn't seen since 2022. Prince Harry's previously said it's not safe for his family to visit Britain without protection, which ceased when he stopped being a working royal in 2020.
The Guardian highlights figures from an NHS watchdog suggesting that 1 in 7 patient hospital referrals in England get lost, rejected or delayed. The paper says Health Watch England survey also found that the majority of those patients only discovered they weren't on a waiting list after chasing the NHS themselves.
According to the Times this morning, every workplace will be required to tell staff about their right to join a union as part of the government's employment rights bill. The paper says an approved statement will be given to workers in an effort to stop what it calls hostile employers from discouraging union membership. The Conservatives have warned that the plan will lead to a collapse of British productivity.
And many of the papers carry triumphant pictures of an emotional Lando Norris after the British driver won his first Formula One championship. It proves, the Telegraph says, that nice guys win too. The back page headline in The Eye is Lando, Hope and Glory.
We're going to be speaking to his childhood karting coach before 9 o'clock this morning, who unsurprisingly said there was always a little gem of something there buried underneath.
We agreed that champions can cry.
Oh, yes. I think so. I cry at far smaller things than that. It's quite a big thing to happen in one's life. So I think if you can, that's definitely a moment to do it. It is 12 minutes past six now. Thailand's military has said that one of its soldiers has been killed in a new wave of border clashes with neighbouring Cambodia. At the moment, both are accusing each other of breaching a ceasefire agreement. Jonathan Head is our Southeast Asia correspondent. Jonathan, good morning. Just tell us what's been happening in the last few hours.
It's been pretty busy up on the border. The Thais have said Cambodia has been firing rockets. These are these multi-launch rockets that are inherently an indiscriminate weapon. So they've evacuated tens of thousands of people, moved them to safer places, to temporary shelters. So they're accusing Cambodia of escalating. We haven't seen those rockets fired since the serious violence back in July. The death of the Thai soldier came amid a series of clashes. Now, clashes or sort of standoffs between soldiers along that border are not unusual, despite the big claims made by President Trump when he had this ceremony in Malaysia in October where he claimed that he'd solved the problem. It wasn't solved. There's a lot of tension, but they don't normally result in, and this is really escalating much beyond what we've seen in recent months. So the question is whether both sides will pull back now. Thailand has had launched airstrikes. Clearly, artillery is being fired by both sides. Although the messages we're hearing from each government are quite restrained, you know, both sides saying they do not want this to escalate any further. What will be interesting to see, I think, is what President Trump makes of it, if anything, because he did make very, very big claims, you know, to be a peacemaker, to have solved this thing. And now it looks like everything he claimed to have achieved in October is in tatters. Is he going to intervene again? The Cambodians would like him to, the Thais rather less so. But this is an unresolved border dispute where there is very little trust building going on. Thailand's been accusing Cambodia of sowing landmines. It's had 7 of its soldiers lose limbs. You know, there's a lot of bad feeling there.
Mm. What will it take to rescue that agreement, Jonathan? Will anything less than another intervention by President Trump, as you describe, work?
Well, I suppose it would, in the sense that both countries are very dependent on the best trade relations they can get with the US. They're both exporting countries, and President Trump has used that leverage. The question is whether he's got the bandwidth to deal with it. You know, he has trumpeted Thailand, Cambodia as one of the wars he says he's ended since he came to office. Will that make it, you know, can make him feel, well, I've got to get involved? Or with Ukraine bogging him down at the moment and so many other issues in the United States, is he just going to think, well, they're two relatively minor countries, let them get on with it? But if he doesn't, the problem is the border dispute is difficult to resolve. It's historic. There are political reasons why each country is not in a mood to make concessions, why banging the nationalist card works for them. It's going to be very difficult to get progress on that border, even if you do get the President of the United States involved again.
Jonathan Head, our Southeast Asia correspondent, thank you.
It's now 6:15. Today marks a year since the fall of the Assad regime in Damascus and the arrival of a new leader in Syria. He used to be labelled a terrorist by the United States, but is now welcomed in the White House. Our Middle East correspondent, Hugo Pachega, is in Damascus this morning. Are they marking the anniversary there, Hugo?
Yeah, Nick, good morning. So I'm just outside Umayyad Square in central Damascus. This is where the main events to mark this day will be held later today, a day many here call Liberation Day, the day Bashar al-Assad fled the country and 5 decades of dictatorship ended. There is a very festive atmosphere here. There's a huge security operation as well. Today has been declared a public holiday across the country. And I remember being in Syria a year ago, days after Bashar al-Assad fell. And I remember how people were coming to us to share their stories of fear, repression, suffering, to say how they felt free and empowered. And a year later, they're still celebrating being free, but obviously they face huge challenges. Syrians are struggling with high unemployment, a rising cost of living. Prices have gone up. Bread and electricity, for example, are more expensive. Almost no reconstruction has taken place. Much of the country is still in ruins. And obviously, minorities still fear the authorities. Hundreds of people have been killed in sectarian killings in the past year. So this is obviously behind a lot of mistrust here. But many of the Syrians that I have met here in Damascus in recent days say they are optimistic that the situation is difficult, but the authorities still need more time and help. So if there is some frustration and discontent, there's also patience and hope.
And in the background, Hugo, we can hear, is it fireworks or gunfire for celebrating that anniversary?
This is fireworks, Nick, and a huge event is expected to happen here in central Damascus, and also events are expected to be held across the country today. There will be also a speech by President Ahmed al-Sharaa, who is obviously the former al-Qaeda commander who led the anti-Assad rebels last year. He's been working to consolidate his transformation as the new leader of Syria. So there's also internationally a huge effort to help this government. You mentioned, you know, that al-Sharaa, the president, is, having the support of President Trump, of the White House. I think a lot of people know that if this government doesn't succeed, the alternative could be much worse and the country could end up in chaos and violence.
Hugo Pachega in Damascus. Thank you. We're going to be hearing from Jeremy Bowen on his reflections a year on in about an hour or so's time.
It's 6:18. Now, President Trump has warned one of the biggest mergers in Hollywood history could, in his words, be a problem. Will Bain's got more on that and the rest of the day's business news as well. Hello, Will.
Hello, Anna. Morning, Nick. Yes, this was this blockbuster deal that Fliss was chatting about at the end of last week here on the programme that would see Netflix buy Warner Brothers in a $70 billion plus deal. But there's been concerns, not just from President Trump, but others, that what that would mean in terms of the streaming landscape in the United States, with the tie-up between Netflix and Warner's own streamer, HBO Max, breaching the US threshold of a 30% market share. A little bit earlier on, we spoke to Bill Kovacic, formerly chair of the US's competition watchdog, the Federal Trade Commission.
This declaration by the president, that as he put it, I'll be involved in the decision too. Which means the negotiation of any possible solution is going to run through the White House. And that means that we're going to have probably a deep level, an unprecedented level of presidential control in the resolution of what used to be a technical analysis of a merger. The president has been attracted in the past to commitments to deal with his social agenda involving the filtering of conservative speech, the elimination of DEI programs. We could have, in short, a collection of other commitments that don't directly have anything to do with the technical competition issues themselves.
That was Bill Kovacic, formerly chair of the Federal Trade Commission. Well, Blair Westlake is also with us. Blair's senior media executive, was formerly chair of Universal Studios Television and Networks Group, and also oversaw Microsoft Media and Entertainment Licensing. Blair, morning.
Good morning.
First of all, then, President Trump's concerns seem to be mostly about market share. Is that going to be the hurdle for this?
Well, you know, I think what we're seeing is, and it's taken a while to actually get its legs, but I think we're going to start to see more and more consolidation. It's just a fact of life. The changes that have occurred in the motion picture business, in particular, in other words, making movies principally for initial release in theaters, has gone through a struggle time over the last 20, 25 years with declining attendance. And I draw analogy much like what occurred in the music industry starting around 2004, where you had five major music companies, including in the UK, cherished company EMI, and we're now at three. And I think we're going to see the same occurring here. Mm. And the fact of the matter is that when you really look at this size, the only two pieces that matter are Netflix and HBO. Netflix is not in the studio production business the way Warner Brothers is, and even the library size of films and television programming that Netflix owns pales in comparison to Warner. So I think it's...
And their argument, Blair, isn't it? And we've heard it already from Netflix in the early stages of this, trying to head off this problem, has been that, to your point, not only has the kind of way movies are made and streaming changed completely, but actually how people watch it has changed completely too. And we've talked on the program a number of times about the growth of YouTube TV, for example, as well, other places that people are streaming this content, that it isn't just through one of the kind of traditional streaming apps either now. And they're saying actually that's the competition, not other conventional streaming platforms.
That is true. A lot of people don't realize that the number one place that consumers in the world go for viewing of content consumption is YouTube, and it's far and away beyond anything else. I mean, the gap between Netflix is certainly popular, but yes, I completely agree with the point Netflix is making, which is the transition that we're seeing. I mean, take the movie business. There were 10, 15 years ago, even there were seven windows that occurred, meaning the time that a piece of content was available. You had the first window being theaters, then you had the home entertainment window, DVDs, VHS cassettes, and you know, the pay television, UK Sky, etc. It went on, and the studios reap the revenues from those seven windows. Well, the seven has become really two: the theatrical release of a movie, and then the streaming release of a movie. And
on that, is that last one under pressure as well now, potentially? Because certainly some of the big cinema chains already worried about what this might mean for movie releases in cinemas.
It's certainly true. It's a chicken and egg, because what's happening is as fewer people are attending the cinema, and that has been on the decline for, you know, the number of tickets sold. Forget the revenues, because in many respects, it's thrown by price increases and et cetera. But the number of people attending cinemas for the last 25 years has declined every single solitary year. And what is occurring is that people are much more, they've gravitated to the home experience. And many of the programs that are being produced for streaming, in the view of many, is that it exceeds the quality of what is now making its way to movie theaters.
What would be your bet, Blair? Will this happen, do you think?
I think it's a tough one to bet because of what I'll call the propensity for here in the U.S. for the current White House to be meddling in transactions that we've never, as your earlier guest commented, we've not seen. It's unprecedented. Ultimately, I believe it will be. I think that there will probably be concessions that have to be made, as often occurs with high visibility transactions on an antitrust level. But I think that the experts that have weighed in so far, and I don't know whether it's been reported there, but it was reported earlier today in the U.S. by Bloomberg. I think they broke the story that Ted Sarandos, the co-CEO, paid a visit to President Trump last month. And while President Trump made comments earlier today about the size of the market share that the combined company would have, it certainly was a wise move, I guess I'd call it, on Ted Sarandos' part to have paid a visit to the president, at least explained it before the president, as he often does, reacts before having the facts.
Plenty of politics as well as business to navigate going forward as well. Blair, thanks so much for your time. Blair Westlake, senior media executive, formerly chair of Universal Studios Television there. Well, Sabitha Subramaniam is with us this morning, our investor. She's head of investment strategy at Saracen & Partners. Morning, Sabitha.
Good morning.
Quick thought on that tie-up then, and the consolidation point in particular. We're going to see more and more of this in the big entertainment firms.
I think, you know, with technology firms now being the main player in Hollywood, I think we will get more consolidation. And I really think the question is whether, when it becomes too concentrated. So the biggest players are Netflix, Amazon, and YouTube. And, you know, they are really quite an unstoppable force, basically because their business models are underpinned by more increasing returns to scale type models.
Yeah, and other ways of raising revenue, of course, within the businesses too. In terms of the stock market this week, Sabitha, is it all about what happens with the Federal Reserve, the US central bank this week, and interest rates?
Yes, I mean, talking about concentration, I think in terms of just markets, I think everyone is laser focused on what the Fed is likely to do on Wednesday in terms of interest rates. I think we're looking at the 7th interest rate cut in the US at a time where inflation is now closer to 3% and has remained above target for the greater part of 4 years. And, you know, it's going to be a highly divisive decision because there will be quite a few dissents. We've had no data in the US because of the shutdown for a period of time.
And Sabitha, quick thought, shares in Magnum, the ice cream company, go on sale today to investors after it was spun out by Unilever. What did you make of the move there?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, this is the demerger really suggests that, you know, Unilever is seeking to focus its business on its stable consumer goods part, and more the cyclical seasonal ice cream business will probably be better off managed as a cyclical seasonal business. So I think, you know, this demerger is interesting because it's really showing how companies, you know, facing huge amounts of, you know, complexity in terms of the consumer are starting to focus.
Well, for a bit more on that, Ian Maskell is with us. He is the former global vice president at Unilever's Wall's Ice Cream. Ian, morning.
Good morning, Will.
How much of this is about Unilever itself then sort of streaming down what it does, and how much is it about a sort of new lease of life for the ice cream businesses outside the company?
Well, really, it's both. I mean, there's no question that Unilever is looking to focus, as your previous contributor just said, and that, you know, it's a complicated business, and it's Unilever is much more focused on health and wellness and, if you like, those kind of categories, whereas ice cream is a pure indulgence category which is perceived as being unhealthy and is on the wrong side of the ultra-processed foods debate and is facing regulations. But I think the general feeling in the ice cream business is that if you get the chance to focus, there's so much more you can do to grow that business and make it a much more powerful snack food business.
Yeah, the new business is going to include Ben and Jerry's brands as well, and already headlines being made by the new chief exec, who has told the FT that he thinks it's time for the founders of Ben and Jerry's to leave the business.
Yeah, I mean, that story is a very long-running story with Ben and Jerry's. And I think, you know, it probably reminds everyone that there's no such thing as bad publicity and that Ben and Jerry's gets a lot of airtime from that discussion. And, you know, the truth is that Ben and Jerry's is a fantastic ice cream that consumers love. And, you know, I think that, you know, Ben and Jerry themselves are very strong campaigners for social causes, etc. And they'll continue to make that a story. But nonetheless, I think Ben and Jerry's will power on regardless of that challenge.
And you think this could potentially then be win-win here?
Yeah, that's one way of putting it. I mean, I don't see any particular damage to Ben and Jerry's. And I think Ben and Jerry themselves are admirable campaigners who will continue to fight the causes they believe in.
Ian, thanks so much for your time this morning. Ian Maskell, the former global vice president at Unilever's Walls Ice Cream.
Well, thank you very much indeed. 29 minutes past six. Here's Carthy with some rather exciting
stuff. Yeah, let's start with something positive, shall we? Great Britain's Lando Norris has won his first Formula One World Championship.
Lando, this is Zach from McLaren. Is this the world champion hotline?
Yeah.
Good day. Thanks. Good day. Awesome.
Thank you, guys.
The McLaren driver secured the third place he needed in the season-ending Abu Dhabi Grand Prix to take the world title, but Lando Norris made a point of sharing the credit.
Not many people in the world ever get to say they've achieved something like what I've been able to achieve today, and the fact I get to do that for everyone else, you know, my engineers, this is their dream. My mechanics, this is their dream. They can all say that they're constructors and drivers champions, and that's the thing that almost makes me the happiest, honestly.
Well, it's nice to start with a bit of success before moving on to the Ashes. England's men lost the second test against Australia by 8 wickets to go 2-0 down in the 5-match series. England captain Ben Stokes had some interesting thoughts after a second defeat.
It's the moments in the games where it's on the line. Is it fight? Is it character? Is it the mentality that we're taking out there as a group? That's what I've got to find out. That's what I've got to ask. There's a saying that we said a lot here in the dressing room. Australia isn't for weak men, but a dressing room that I'm captain of isn't a place for weak men either. Yeah, look, we need to dig deep. I need to dig deep, and I need to get this team in a place where we do go out there in Melbourne and we are seriously switched on. But yeah, I've got no doubt about the guys in there are capable of winning the Sashes.
We'll be speaking to David Gower about those comments later in the programme. Crystal Palace are up to fourth place in the Premier League table after a 2-1 win over Fulham. West Ham remain in the relegation zone after a 1-1 draw with Brighton. Wilfried Nancy's debut as Celtic manager ended in a 2-1 defeat to Hearts, who moved 3 points clear at the top of the Scottish Premiership, while Manchester City extended their lead at the top of the Women's Super League with a 3-0 win over Leicester City. Edinburgh shocked French giants Toulon with a 33-20 win in Rugby Union's European Champions Cup. And there were also important Champions Cup wins for Northampton Saints and Gloucester. And Mark Selby beat Judd Trump 10 frames to 8 to win his third UK snooker championship title 18 months after he considered quitting the sport.
I wasn't enjoying it, you know. I was performing poor, not really enjoying the challenge, and thought to myself, maybe I should start looking at something else. But, you know, I've got no qualifications from school at all, so I got nothing to fall back on. So I had to regroup and thought, you know what, it's not a bad way to make a living, so I need to carry on.
All in all, I think a successful weekend-ish.
Yeah, ish. It was. Thank you, Carthy. Now, time for a quick word about this year's Radio 4 Christmas appeal with St Martin in the Fields.
The warmth, belonging and security we all seek at Christmas should be available to everyone.
There's no telling who might be thinking of just trying to attack you, steal from you.
You have people walking past. Anything can happen. You don't know what's happening out there.
This festive season, you can help those in our society facing or experiencing homelessness.
What do I think about my life now? I feel like I'm on top of the world.
Please give to the BBC Radio 4 Christmas Appeal with St Martin in the Fields by donating online on the Radio 4 Christmas Appeal website.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson. The time now is 28 minutes to 7. Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news for us.
Sir Keir Starmer will welcome Volodymyr Zelensky to Downing Street later today to discuss the US-backed plan on ending the war in Ukraine. President Macron of France and the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz will also attend the meeting. Donald Trump has accused Mr. Zelensky of failing to read the latest peace plan, claiming that the Ukrainian people loved it. The head of the Royal Navy is expected to set out how the UK plans to tackle the Russian threat to undersea cables and pipelines after 2 years of increased activity close to Britain's underwater infrastructure. The plans are reported to include a hybrid naval force which combines autonomous vehicles and AI with warships and aircraft. Sir Keir Starmer is to announce a £725 million investment to create 50,000 new apprenticeships in England. Some of them will be created in sectors including AI, hospitality and engineering. The number of young people starting apprenticeships has fallen by almost 40% in the past decade. Thailand says it's launched airstrikes on military positions along its disputed border with Cambodia. Both sides are blaming each other for a fresh wave of clashes which began over the weekend. Thai authorities say one of their soldiers has been killed. Nigerian media are reporting that security forces have freed 100 children who were kidnapped from a Catholic boarding school. More than 2 weeks ago, gunmen stormed the school in a remote community in Niger State, abducting more than 300 pupils. Just under 32% of voters took part in yesterday's elections in Hong Kong, despite a campaign by the pro-Beijing government urging people to vote. Four people were arrested for posts on social media telling the public to stay at home. A water leak at the Louvre Museum in Paris has damaged hundreds of books. It took place late last month in the Egyptian department. The items will be dried, sent to a bookbinder and restored before being returned to the shelves.
Thank you, Caroline. It is now 26 minutes to seven. Ukraine's President Zelensky is in London today for a meeting with the Prime Minister, with President Macron of France and Chancellor Merz of Germany to discuss how to handle Donald Trump's latest push for peace. Our diplomatic correspondent, James Landell, will be following this for us. Morning to you, James. Struck by the statement in the US national security strategy over the weekend, the European leaders had, quote, unrealistic expectations for the end of this war. That presumably is the backdrop to these conversations.
It certainly provides the context. I mean, that document has sent a lot of shivers down diplomatic spines across Europe, simply because it took extraordinary steps towards the Russian position and away from the European position, specifically on Ukraine, saying that the United States wanted merely an expeditious end to the fighting, and it sought to re-establish strategic stability with Russia. And at no point did that document ever actually condemn Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. So that sets a pretty bleak context for today's talks. I think we're at that stage of a now familiar cycle here where Donald Trump starts expressing frustration with the Ukrainian side and Zelensky, and the Europeans sort of huddle round and rally support. And I think that's what we're going to see a lot of today. The key issues, as ever, are security and territory. On security, it's about whether or not the Americans and Europeans can offer Ukraine enough security guarantees to deter future Russian aggression. And on territory, as ever, the question of the Russian demand that it takes land in the Donbass that it hasn't currently taken militarily. Zelensky had long talks on the telephone with Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, the key US envoys, on Saturday, 5 hours of talks, which he described as constructive but not easy. They were clearly difficult conversations. Two other Ukrainian officials are flying back from the US to brief Mr. Zelensky today about it. So we're clearly reaching a crunch point here.
Is there any suggestion that European leaders will put pressure on Zelensky to trade land for greater promises on security and sovereignty?
Well, that is the question. And thus far, no European leader has dared to suggest anything publicly, not least because it would go against everything the European leaders have said for the last 4 years. However, every so often there are hints, nods, some European leaders saying there might have to be difficult choices. I think the difficulty for for Zelensky is giving up territory in Donbass that has not been conquered by the Russians after many, many years of war is politically very, very unpalatable and very, very hard for him to get over that lip. And I think that at the moment, the question for the Europeans will be, is that price worth paying? Is it worth trying to force the Ukrainians to accept a deal that they consider to be unacceptable? And risk the consequences of that. And I think that is going to be a crunch point in coming days too.
James Landell, our diplomatic correspondent, thank you.
It's 22 minutes to seven now.
The Kremlin has praised that document that James was talking about, the new US national security strategy, as, quote, largely consistent with their vision, as Europe's leaders are left to wonder what the attacks on them for allowing the civilizational erasure of the continent really mean. Earlier this morning, I spoke to our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman, and asked him whether the Kremlin's praise will worry people in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, the Russians are saying that what has been written by the White House is largely consistent with the Russian vision. I think that will not surprise the many Democrats in Washington that over the last 48 hours have been heaping criticism on this document. I think in terms of you know, where it leaves the view and the policy of the White House, I think nothing will change. I think they very much intended for this document to be seen as, first of all, it's sort of, you know, I would say this is the most detailed written exposition we have had of the second Donald Trump term foreign policy. I would say it's largely, it feels to me, been written likely by his deputy chief of staff, Stephen Miller, who has always been the sort of most or the sort of ideological channel for parts of the MAGA base that, you know, want to shape the world in the view of the way they see the United States. And I think that's why in this document, you know, there isn't much criticism really for any of the traditional rivals or adversaries of the US. And then it gets to this section on Europe, in which vitriol basically is heaped on the direction of Europe, this idea of a sort of rot and decay from within, which is largely based on the idea of the sort of, you know, feckless liberalism and attachment to multilateralism in the form of the EU, and largely mass migration, which the document says is leading to civilizational erasure and an attack on Western identity.
It's an extraordinary phrase, isn't it, for a document which is going to be read by your principal allies?
Yeah, and that's why it has, you know, seen, I mean, many Europeans, albeit trying to be diplomatic, but, you know, former officials and former leaders saying that this is turning the Europeans into an enemy when they're actually, of course, an ally. But I think it, you know, it deepens this crisis between Europe and the US at the moment and the Trump administration, when the talks on Russia-Ukraine have reached this absolutely critical point. There is a deep fear among Europeans that Washington is about to sell out Ukraine. They are desperately trying to shore up the position of Ukraine. And I think only feel that they have just managed to escape the possibility of a couple of weeks ago, where the Trump administration was putting a week-long deadline on Ukraine and the Europeans going with this vision that was heavily tilted towards the Russians. So, you know, it's done nothing to allay those fears.
Tom Bateman, our US State Department correspondent, thank you.
It's 19 minutes to 7. The Telegraph is reporting this morning that a former member of Nigel Farage's Reform UK campaign team has gone to the police over claims of falsified election expenses. Henry Zuffman is our chief political correspondent. Morning, Henry. What more do we know about this?
Morning, Anna. Yes, the claim in this exclusive story in the Telegraph this morning is that thousands of pounds of spending during Nigel Farage's election campaign for Clacton in 2024 were unaccounted for. This claim comes from Richard Everett, who was a member of Nigel Farage's campaign team. He claimed that the undeclared expenses included things like the hiring of two vans fitted with Reform advertising boards, the hire of an armoured vehicle for a rally late on in the campaign. And he says that those and other things, if they'd been properly declared, would have taken the campaign over its spending limit of just over £20,000. Now, as you say, he has told the Telegraph that he's handed documents to the Metropolitan Police. Very important to stress, we have tried, but we have not managed to speak to Mr. Everett ourselves, and the Met Police hasn't yet confirmed to us that they have received this complaint. Reform UK are saying the claims are inaccurate and come from a disgruntled former councillor. And what they mean by that is that Mr. Everett, they say, was expelled from Reform over allegations of his personal misconduct several months ago. Also worth noting, electoral offences are usually, though not absolutely always, subject to a one-year time limit. Well, that would have expired here. But clearly this has the potential, at least, to be unwelcome news for Nigel Farage after weeks of uncomfortable questions for him about his conduct as a schoolboy.
And the government this morning, Henry, announcing more investment into apprenticeships. But as always, there are some questions around the outside about the way that the money is being raised from bigger businesses, and also whether or not the number of apprenticeships that will be created is big enough to make a difference.
Yeah, absolutely right. So this is a £725 million package. We knew that money was being allocated, but new details from the government today on how it's going to work. And they say the money will fully fund apprenticeships for people aged under 25, at small and medium-sized businesses, especially in sectors including AI, hospitality and engineering. And certainly one of Keir Starmer's themes in recent months has been about talking up apprenticeships. Remember at the Labour Party conference, he talked about wanting to encourage more young people into vocational education rather than just university. And it also overlaps quite a bit with what we heard from the government at the weekend, which is their concern about the number of young people not in employment, education or training. Those are the so-called NEETs. I mean, I think some of the things the government is doing, including this, are likely to be very popular with the Labour side. But there are other elements, including to what the government was talking about over the weekend, to how, getting young people on benefits into training or work experience, where those might involve sanctions or down the line possible cuts to benefit spending. That's where things could get, I think, politically more controversial for the government.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
16 minutes to seven.
Now, the Royal Navy is unveiling some of the ways in which it plans to counter what the government regards as an increasingly serious threat from Russia to the UK's critical undersea infrastructure. It follows a series of recent incidents in which Russian vessels have been found operating suspiciously around UK waters. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams has been assessing what the Navy's response may look like.
In the hunt for Russian intruders, the Navy is looking for solutions. Off the west coast of Scotland, an underwater glider, like a torpedo with wings, dives under the waves and drifts off into the darkness. Bristling with sensors, the SG-1 Fathom is capable of patrolling for months on end. It's designed to operate autonomously in large packs. It's made by the German defence technology company Helsing, but it's here being trialled for the Royal Navy. Katie Rain is the programme manager.
So the glider operates under the waves. It patrols through the depths of the oceans, monitoring and listening for adversaries that might be in the area. What it does is the AI actually embedded in the glider, it processes and identifies those threats more quickly than we've been able to do previously.
It's all part of a network the Navy is calling Atlantic Bastion, a system which links drones, warships and surveillance aircraft in an effort to protect vital undersea cables and pipelines.
At 10, the UK is exploring military options if a Russian spy ship sails closer to British shores. It's claimed the vessel, the Yantar, has directed...
The urgency of the project was underlined recently by the activities of a Russian research vessel suspected of secretly mapping Britain's critical undersea infrastructure. Part of a wider pattern of Russian activity at sea and in the air, causing ripples of alarm across Europe. In Portsmouth, on the day Britain and Norway announced their navies will be working together in the North Atlantic, the Defence Secretary John Healey and his Norwegian counterpart are piped aboard an experimental ship, the Patrick Blackett, used as a testbed for new technologies.
This is a T-150 drone, 150 pounds in weight or 68 kilograms in metric.
On the deck, an array of high-tech gear, including drones and a pilotless helicopter. On the water beside us, a crewless speedboat zips up and down. And up on the dock looms Excalibur, the Navy's first unmanned and highly experimental submarine.
This is about keeping us ahead of the Russians.
John Healey is clear about what all this is for. The past 2 years have seen a sharp increase in the number of Russian vessels poking around in British waters.
We know the threat that Russia poses. We track what they're... ships do. We track what their submarines are doing. We know that they are mapping our undersea cables and our networks and our pipelines. And we know that they are developing new capabilities all the time to put those at risk.
This is the operator room, so the operator centre.
Looking on as the politicians are briefed is the man charged with supervising Britain's response, the First Sea Lord General Sir Gwyn Jenkins. He faces a daunting challenge, keeping up with an opponent who hasn't declared war, but is investing heavily and behaving aggressively.
Despite the cost of the war in Ukraine to them, they continue to put hundreds of billions of dollars worth of investment into their submarine fleet. I would say we, the Allies, we're still ahead in the Atlantic, but it's not by as much of an advantage as I would like. I think we are being pressed and we're definitely in a competition to stay ahead of where the Russians are.
is it accurate to describe it as a kind of hybrid war?
It definitely is. In many ways, that is exactly what we're in at the moment.
Russia says it's Britain that's being provocative, even hysterical. But the military says it's clear-eyed about the current dangers, and it's working closely with industry to address them as quickly as possible.
Paul Adams reporting there. It is now 11 minutes to 7. Should women be offered smaller portions than men in restaurants? As on average, they need 25% fewer calories. Should we all be offered smaller, cheaper portions when we eat out or we take out? Well, that's a debate that has been kicked off by the man who chairs the Obesity Healthcare Goals Programme. He's Professor Naveed Sattar of the University of Glasgow and joins us now. Morning to you.
Yeah, morning, Nick.
Well, let's start with the provocative suggestion that women should be offered different food. Was that the suggestion of your group, or is that a neat headline that's been put on it?
Yeah, it was the latter. We didn't. I mean, actually, this was this whole article was prompted by women who often, when they go to restaurants or look for ready meals, they often come as one size, geared towards the sort of the average male size. So clearly, that nudges women to overeat in many sort of social circumstances. And I think when you look at the statistics, obesity is now rising faster in women in many parts of the world, in fact, perhaps all parts of the world, and in people who are younger as well, and that's a major problem.
So your argument is that people need help by being offered smaller portions?
No, absolutely. And people then can choose. I mean, one portion could be called normal, and the other one could be reduced calories. So it's not about denigrating women at all. We actually didn't even consider that. It's about offering different portion sizes that people can choose relative to their body size and therefore reduce the push on obesity. If we provide bigger portions for many people, they feel compelled to finish their plate. That then leads to gradual overeating. And if they don't finish their plate, someone often in their company finishes their plate. Maybe leads to more food waste, and effectively increases everyone's chances of over-consuming calories, and that's a big issue.
But maybe you put your finger on a problem there, which is a culture of saying, I need to clear the plate, rather than I need to eat what I require and I'm hungry for.
No, it doesn't work that way, Nick. I think if you have a plate of food in front of you, it's not so much that you're... It's obesity comes back down to willpower. It's not willpower, it's about sort of... In the sense, it's your genes and environment. And if you have too much food around you, we are generally compelled to overeat.
Compelled? It's a very strong word, Professor.
No, I think it's true. I mean, look at what's happened over the last 50 years, Nick. Our genes have not changed at all. We are not greedier or lazier than prior generations. What's happened is there's far too much food in society everywhere. And one of the small but simple changes, meaningful changes we could make is offering different portion sizes that allows people to choose lesser calories in certain circumstances, be that women, be that a smaller man, be that a younger child who's with a family. And all these aspects do matter. And there are many changes that need to be made, but this could be one of the small, easy win changes. Of course, it means that food companies will have to provide different portion sizes, but actually that's better for everybody.
But what's interesting about what you're saying, and I suspect older listeners may object to, is the idea that the food environment, as it's called, compels, your word, people to eat. There are plenty of older people who say, well, just don't eat it. If you don't need it, don't have it.
No, but that's... So here's the other thing, Nick. Older people were born at a time, generally, and that includes myself, includes you, when the environment was far less obesogenic. Far less obesogenic. So we've lived only a small portion of our lives in the current environment or in the last 10, 20 years. And over the last 20 to 30, 40 years, the environment's become progressively more and more obesogenic. So that then explains why obesity is going up fastest in younger people, because they're born in an environment which is much more obesogenic than you and I were born in. And that's compelling people, in a sense, to overeat. Our genes, as I say, I remind you, our genes have not changed. It's just the amount of food in society, and also our activity levels have also decreased in parallel. And that is leading more and more people all over the world to put on more weight. And that's a sad reality.
Fascinating. Professor Navid Sattar of the University of Glasgow, thank you very much indeed. Just to clarify, and I was not alive during rationing. Could we just clarify?
It's an important clarification. I'm glad we could get that out of the way. Get the record straight. It is 7 minutes to 7 now. Two children who were medically evacuated from Gaza will visit 10 Downing Street for tea with the Prime Minister today. With them will be campaigners who want more in need of urgent medical treatment to be brought here to receive it. We'll offer him a flower. He is a campaigner, director of the British Arab Nursing and Midwifery Association. Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us more about these two children who came to the UK, the treatment they've had and the difference it's made to them.
Yeah, so thanks for having me this morning. So Mahmoud is 12 years old and recently arrived to the UK from Gaza. They were all evacuated to Jordan initially. Mahmoud is seriously unwell at the moment. He has something called kidney stenosis, which means basically that he gets extremely high blood pressure, which subsequently puts pressure on his heart. He actually last week was readmitted to hospital. And the sad thing for Mahmoud is his mother isn't with him at the moment. She's still stuck in Gaza with other siblings and was not able to come to the UK with Mahmoud. So he has to live with a long-term condition without his mother. And we're hoping this afternoon that the Prime Minister will listen to his plea to help bring his mother and siblings here. So he really needs his mum at this current time. The second child who'll be meeting the Prime Minister is Ubaida, who's 15. Sadly, Ubaida, his tent was hit by an Israeli missile whilst he was asleep. And he sadly lost his foot and his arm above the elbow. And I think really for Ubaida, he's a child who's really into sport, loves football, and has really struggled psychologically to live with the fact that, you know, he may not be able to do the sports that he really loves to do.
Yeah, and such a big part of your campaign is that children, as you described there, who have either injuries from the war or long-term health conditions, things which are treatable here, are not treatable in Gaza. And you're going to be asking for more children to be able to come here and receive that treatment.
Absolutely. So what we know so far, only 50 children who need medical help have arrived in the UK. And the government has previously talked about 300 children, and we would really like to see this expedited. We know that there are thousands of children in Gaza that are in desperate need of medical care and can be treated very easily here in the UK. And many of these children are dying needlessly every day in Gaza. And we know for a fact that it is the most dangerous place in the world for a child to be at the moment. And we really want to push this 300 and even more when we know that thousands really need urgent medical care and we're able to provide that care.
And that's a conversation you're going to be having when you hand that letter to the Prime Minister later today. Ofra Muflahi, thank you for joining us, campaigner and director of the British Arab Nursing and Midwifery Association.
I'm Katie Razzle, the BBC's culture editor, and this is the story of a book.
It's a wonderful book. She's an immensely talented and immensely valuable writer.
Award-winning, commercially and critically successful, then cancelled.
It just infuriates me. You're reinforcing stereotypes.
I remember feeling sick by page 8, maybe.
A culture war about race, class and who has the right to say what.
I do not think that I wrote in any way a racist book.
6 episodes, considering different perspectives. Anatomy of a Cancellation from BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
Time for the weather. Here's Simon.
Thank you, Anna. Good morning. The weather is going to turn really quite windy and very wet through tomorrow into Wednesday, potentially quite stormy for some in the northwest of Scotland. So well worth staying tuned to the forecast for. For today in southwest England and Wales, well, this morning starting off a little bit showery, rain spreading into southwest England at the moment as well. As we go through the rest of this morning, most of the showers will clear from Wales. There'll be some sunny spells developing, but it'll stay fairly cloudy in southwestern parts, and with that, some patchy rain just edging its way a bit further north and eastward as the day goes on. A bit breezy, but quite mild. Temperatures about 11 to 13 degrees. Now, for the Midlands, eastern and southeastern areas of England, we'll see a few showers moving through, but there'll be some bright, some sunnier spells for a time this morning before the cloud thickens up during this afternoon. And again, some rain will move its way in across some southern areas as we go through the afternoon, and temperatures get to 12 to 14 degrees. So again, really quite mild for the time of year. Across northern England, some showers across northwestern parts this morning, moving eastward. Those clearing away fairly quickly. We'll see some sunny spells through today, but the cloud will increase from the south. Temperatures 10 to 12 Celsius. For Northern Ireland today, there'll eventually be some sunny spells through this morning, but showers move in by lunchtime in the early afternoon, highs of 9 to 11. And across Scotland, some heavy rain in southwestern areas of Scotland this morning, moving north and eastward. It'll start to break up across northern Scotland around about lunchtime, then some sunny spells with showers, mostly in western Scotland, highs of 7 to 10 degrees. But through tonight, turning very wet and increasingly windy into Tuesday.
Thank you, Simon. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson.
Good morning, it's 7 o'clock on Monday the 8th of December. The headlines this morning: Ukraine's President Zelensky is heading to Downing Street for talks with Sir Keir Starmer about the US plan for peace. But Donald Trump has again expressed disappointment with the attitude of the Ukrainian leader. The government says it's going to create 50,000 new apprenticeships in England. We'll speak to the Skills Minister, Jackie Smith, at 10 to 8. And reports from Nigeria say the security forces have freed 100 children who were kidnapped from a school last month.
Also in the next hour, a year after the fall of the Assad regime, our international editor, Jeremy Bowen, reports from Syria.
They're all bearing marks of where they've been injured by explosions, and also one of them, Ali, is coughing badly. His lungs have been damaged, I think, by smoke he's inhaled from munitions that they were burning off.
And when is a sausage not a sausage? Brussels is about to rule. That's all after the BBC News, read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
President Zelensky will be welcomed to Downing Street by Sir Keir Starmer today for talks on the American proposal to end the war between Ukraine and Russia. They'll be joined by the French and German leaders as European powers try to make sure that Kiev receives security guarantees if there's a ceasefire. Donald Trump has expressed fresh frustration with Mr. Zelensky after days of high-level discussions between the US and Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky says the talks hadn't been easy. Our correspondent Joel Gunter reports from Kiev.
President Zelensky will be looking to shore up military and security support as he meets Sir Keir Starmer and other European leaders at a pivotal moment for peace talks. Mr. Zelensky's visit follows days of difficult negotiations between Ukraine and the US in Florida, as well as heavy Russian airstrikes in recent nights against Ukrainian infrastructure. And now, just hours ahead of the meeting, criticism from Donald Trump, who accused the Ukrainian leader of failing to read the latest peace plan.
Russia is, I believe, fine with it, but I'm not sure that Zelensky is fine with it. His people love it, but he hasn't read it.
Mr. Trump seems to have been referring to a statement from Mr. Zelensky last night in which the Ukrainian leader said he was waiting for a full briefing from his negotiating team. In reality, there is deep disquiet among Ukrainians about Russia's demands, particularly for territory it has so far failed to capture on the battlefield. In eastern Ukraine, fighting rages around the key city of Pokrovsk, and Russian airstrikes have left residents here facing severe power and heating shortages as they head into the depths of winter.
The head of the Royal Navy is expected to set out today how the UK plans to tackle the threats Russia poses to undersea cables and pipelines. During the past 2 years, there's been increased activity by Russian ships operating close to the UK's underwater infrastructure. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
The government says the threat posed by Russia to the UK's underwater infrastructure is real and needs to be confronted. Last month, a suspected Russian spy ship, the Yantar, pointed lasers at RAF pilots tracking its movement close to UK waters. The Navy is developing an initiative known as Atlantic Bastion, a network combining existing ships, submarines and aircraft with a new generation of unmanned vessels and drones. The aim is to identify and confront threats more quickly than before. Skeptics say the Navy lacks the resources to do the job properly. The First Sea Lord, General Sir Gwyn Jenkins, says a revolutionary underwater network is taking shape. He'll be setting out his vision for the future of the Royal Navy in a speech later today.
The Prime Minister is to announce £725 million of funding to create 50,000 new apprenticeships in England. Some will be in sectors including AI, hospitality and engineering. The government wants to reverse a 40% fall in the number of young people starting apprenticeships over the past decade. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Sir Keir Starmer will visit a McLaren centre today, perhaps hoping some of the team's Formula One success will rub off. The company uses apprenticeships, which the Prime Minister has said he wants treated with the same respect as degree courses. But there has been a sharp decline in young people starting apprenticeships during the last decade. And the nearly 1 million young people out of work, education or training is a big political challenge. The funding, paid for by larger companies and wider taxes, is part of a package aimed at tackling that. The money will cover the cost of some apprenticeships for under 25s in small and medium-sized businesses.
Thailand says its air force has bombed military positions inside Cambodia after armed clashes along their disputed border. A Thai soldier has been killed. This is the most serious confrontation between the two countries since they signed an American-backed ceasefire in July. It ended 5 days of fighting, which killed dozens of soldiers and civilians. From Bangkok, our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports.
Tens of thousands of people in Thailand are once again being moved to temporary shelters as the Thai military reports multiple rockets being fired from the Cambodian side this morning, a weapon which has not been used since a ceasefire was agreed in July. An armed forces spokesman said Thai Air Force jets had bombed Cambodian military positions after a Thai soldier was killed in an exchange of fire on the disputed border. A Cambodian military spokeswoman has accused the Thai army of opening fire first and insisted that the Cambodian government still stood by the peace agreement signed in October in the presence of President Trump.
Nigerian media are reporting that security forces have freed 100 children who were kidnapped from a Catholic boarding school. More than 2 weeks ago, gunmen stormed the school in a remote community in Niger State, abducting more than 300 pupils and 12 members of staff. From Abuja, Medina Maishonu reports.
The abduction of more than 300 children from St. Mary's Catholic boarding school in Niger State was one of the country's worst mass kidnappings. The Christian Association of Nigeria in Niger State and its Commissioner of Police say they've now received confirmation that 100 students have been rescued by security forces. They said the National Security Advisor's Office told them the children would be released in groups to their parents starting from today. It still isn't clear who is behind this kidnapping, which has shone a spotlight on the country's security situation.
The outgoing head of the UN's refugee agency has warned that Syria is in urgent need of international assistance, a year after the fall of the Assad dictatorship. Filippo Grandi leaves the UNHCR next month at the end of his second five-year term. He told the BBC that unless reconstruction is accelerated, the country could slip backwards. He was speaking to our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who's in Damascus.
Filippo Grandi called it enormous. 3 million Syrians had come home over the past year, far more than expected. But he said they had returned to almost nothing. Houses destroyed, services on the verge of collapse, no jobs. He described Syrians as patient and resilient, but if life didn't improve, he feared they would leave again in frustration. He said there had been some aid and investment, but it was too slow. After his 10 years at the helm of the UN's refugee agency, he said he firmly believed that when a conflict ended, reconstruction and peace building had to move fast and take risks to prevent conflict from erupting again. Mr. Grandi acknowledged that there was still, in his words, a lot of apprehension about issues including the minorities in Syria, as well as the rights of women.
The parents of the three girls killed in the Southport attack in July 2024 have told the BBC how they've supported each other to help them through their grief. During interviews for a special documentary, the parents of Alice De Silva Aguirre, Elsie Dot Stancombe and BB King describe how they've set up charitable projects in their children's names. The organisations offer support and creative opportunities for young people. Sarah Campbell reports.
Alice was 9 years old, Elsie seven and BB six when they were killed while attending a Taylor Swift-themed dance class. Their names and photos have since become widely known as the victims of one of the most shocking crimes in recent years. But their parents are determined to create legacies which reflect who their daughters were. Jenny Stancombe is Elsie's mum.
We all have the same goal, in a sense, to ensure that our girls aren't remembered for this, that they will live on longer than we do.
The three families have established charities and foundations which aim to help other children and young people in their daughters' names.
You can see Our Girls, the Southport Families, on BBC One at 8 o'clock tomorrow evening.
Thank you, Caroline. It's 9 minutes past seven now. President Volodymyr Zelensky is in London today for talks with Keir Starmer, the French President Emmanuel Macron and the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz on attempts to broker a ceasefire in Ukraine. This is against the backdrop of US negotiators travelling to Moscow last week without producing a breakthrough, and President Trump saying overnight that he is, in his words, a little bit disappointed that Mr. Zelensky hasn't yet read the proposal being put forward to end the war. Well, Ivana Klimpush-Sinsadze is chair of the Parliamentary Committee on the Integration of Ukraine to the EU and joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
On that point that President Trump has made about President Zelensky not reading the documentation, what's your understanding of what's happening there?
Well, my understanding is that President Zelensky has said yesterday that he is expecting a full briefing from the Ukrainian part of the negotiation team. And that's probably is read by President Trump as if President Zelensky didn't read the suggestion. But I think details do matter. And I think that, full understanding of what was discussed and what are the nuances is also very important.
There's obviously a lot of European backing for Ukraine and for President Zelensky, and that is on show again today. But do you sometimes wish that they would speak out a little more forcefully in Ukraine's defence with President Trump?
I really think that this is not exclusively about Ukraine. I think that the latest national security strategy of the United States is clearly actually speaking out on the concerns also for the European continent and for European allies, and therefore the threat that comes from Russia and the new policy from the United States, I think, has to make the European partners much more vocal, much more active, and much more capable of acting at this point in support of Ukraine, in defense of Ukraine, but basically in support of themselves and defense of themselves.
More so than they're being at the moment, because they are notably reluctant to directly criticize President Trump, even on matters like this.
Well, I think it's already clear that we have to be much more, much sharper in what we are defending altogether. And we have to be also very clear vis-a-vis the American partners as they pretend to continue being the neutral moderator. But at the same time, it seems that they are getting more and more on the side of the aggressor of the Russian Federation, trying to push Ukraine and Europe into something that is called peace, but which will not lead to lasting and sustainable peace on this continent, and which will redefine again these spheres of influence, which will lead to Russia feeling that it's reestablishing the Soviet-Russian empire in some way, and it will continue attacking other European states, not exclusively Ukraine.
And on that point, what do you think of the ceasefire agreement, the US-backed ceasefire agreement that is on the table at the moment?
Well, I think, we have to call a spade a spade. And I think that the United States believes that they are not negotiating a ceasefire agreement. They believe that they are negotiating, quote unquote, peace deal. Well, a ceasefire agreement would lead to then negotiations on how the lasting and sustainable, and not to mention just, peace would look like. But at this point, I think we are negotiating something that the United States will believe that they can sell as a big victory, which unfortunately doesn't look like one and doesn't look like something that would bring lasting peace to the European continent and to the globe, because the results of this war actually will define also the atmosphere in Indo-Pacific, also in Western Hemisphere as well. But that is somehow not seen by the United States.
Well, we'll see what those European leaders have to say as a result of those talks today. Ivana Klimpush-Sinsadze, thank you for joining us.
It's coming up to 14 minutes past seven. The National Inquiry into Grooming Gangs, promised many months ago, still doesn't exist. The government has struggled to get agreement amongst victims and survivors about how broad the inquiry should be. And, as a result, they've struggled to find someone to chair it as well. This morning, the Conservatives are coming forward with what they say should happen next. The Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Philp, joins us on the line. Morning to you, Mr. Philp. What sort of inquiry do you want to see, and how different would that be from what the government are trying for?
Good morning, Nick. Well, look, the main thing is the government 6 months ago were forced into a U-turn. They never wanted to have this inquiry in the first place. They were dragged kicking and screaming. Here we are half a year later and they have done basically nothing. And their failure makes them complicit in the cover-up of these appalling crimes. We think they need to get on with it. They need to appoint a judge to chair this inquiry. And it needs to have very clear terms of reference. So later on this morning, Kemi Badenoch and I, together with survivors and their families, are going to publish a terms of reference that we have developed with survivors and their families, just to show that this can be done. It doesn't need to take half a year. And the terms of reference we have developed make this a statutory inquiry, meaning the inquiry can summon witnesses, it can compel the production of evidence, it will specifically investigate whether public bodies covered up these appalling crimes simply because the perpetrators were mainly of Pakistani origin, and local councils and the police in the past appeared to be more interested in so-called community relations than they were in protecting the victims, who were predominantly young, vulnerable, white girls.
But forgive me, there was no disagreement with the Home Secretary on that at all, Mr. Philp. She says she wants to look at those issues too. The issue really is whether you can get all survivors to agree. You say that your proposal has the backing of survivors. I suspect it's one group of survivors, isn't it? Because four resigned from the government's panel. Five others said they would resign if you got your way and the safeguarding minister, Jess Phillips, was pushed out of her job. So have you got all survivors signed up to your proposals?
Well, we've got a significant group of survivors signed up to our proposals.
So you haven't got all?
Well, I mean, obviously, there are hundreds of survivors, obviously.
No, there are 20 on a national panel that was appointed to do this. Four resigned, five stayed in post. So you've clearly just taken the side of one group of these survivors.
Well, look, I mean, we actually don't know who the other five are because their names are rightly private. But look,
one of them has gone public with a letter. So we do know.
Well, the main point, Nick, is that half a year ago, we forced the government into a U-turn. We 2 days before a vote in Parliament, they did a complete U-turn. Keir Starmer, by the way, started off smearing campaigners as being on a far-right bandwagon for even calling for this inquiry. So Keir Starmer and Labour never wanted this inquiry in the first place.
Let me
finish the point. No,
I won't let you finish the point because you're going backwards when you said you wanted to go forward. Let's look forward. We're trying to get an agreement on an inquiry. And the man who withdrew from the process of being appointed as chair of that inquiry, when you said the government were doing nothing, they were in fact appointing someone to do the job. He said, and I quote, we have a problem with political opportunism and point scoring. Isn't that what we're seeing this morning from you,
Mr. Phil? No, absolutely not. No, we have constructively come up with quite a long and detailed terms of reference. We developed it very carefully, consulting with a number of survivors and their families. So we're trying to be constructive. The real point
But
is
you haven't achieved the goal of bringing all survivors together, which is the problem, because they have very different views
whether
to have a narrow inquiry or a wider inquiry.
We've brought together all of the survivors that we have been and their family members and supporters that we have been able to contact, which is a fair number. The main point is that it should not have taken half a year to get this far. The government have failed abjectly, dragging their feet, not gripping this issue. And half a year has passed and essentially nothing has happened. And that is completely unacceptable because we need to get to the truth. And the people, the individuals in the police and local councils who deliberately covered up these crimes because the perpetrators were mainly of Pakistani origin and the victims were mainly young, vulnerable white girls, they covered that up and no one has been held to account.
Yes.
And this can't continue to be
delayed. Well, it'll continue a lot longer under your proposal, won't it? Because having a judge-led inquiry, which is not the government's position, will take much longer, cost much more money, and mean that change is made, if it is made, many, many years later than it might otherwise be done.
Well, I don't accept that a judge-led inquiry does need to take years and years and years. I know in the past, some public inquiries have gone on shockingly long. And that's why our terms of reference are clear. This should be done in 2 years, unless there is some particular reason, like a criminal investigation, that causes the inquiry to be in part suspended while a criminal investigation proceeds. But that aside, it should take 2 years, and it should get to the truth quickly and make sure that those people who covered up these appalling crimes for reasons of so-called racial sensitivity get held to account and, frankly, prosecuted for misconduct in public office. We need to get on with this, and that is not currently happening under this government. They are effectively complicit in the cover-up by dragging their feet.
Shadow Home Secretary, thank you for joining us.
19 minutes past seven now. One of the country's biggest investors is calling for further changes to pension rules, claiming it could unlock hundreds of billions of pounds of investment over the next decade. Will Baines back with more on that. Hello again.
Again, Anna. Yeah, new research from Legal & General and Oxford Economics suggests an increase in automatic pension contributions could mobilise more than £200 billion of extra investment by 2035, the pair says. You might remember, though, that the Chancellor, of course, announced in the budget that pension savings made through salary sacrifice schemes would be capped at £2,000 a year before facing tax. Antonio Simões is with us, the Chief Executive of Legal & General. Antonio, morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you on. And I mentioned that last point first because one of your suggestions, as we say in here, is to raise the amount of automatic contributions people make towards their pension. And yet we've had this sort of tax change in the budget around pension contributions.
Yes, so we published a report this morning, Blueprint for Growth, and yes, there's six levers, and one of them is, which I actually am very passionate about, is the increase of auto-enrollment to 12% to improve the adequacy of pensions. And overall, all of the six levers generate £220 billion of additional investment over the next 10 years. So, well, to put that in context, that would be an increase of 0.7%. Of GDP growth. So I, as one of the largest investors in the UK, we have great faith in the power of the UK economy and the role of pensions, which is why these six levers are all related to pensions.
Yeah, but just in terms of the incentivization to do that, if you have a measure that's come from the budget that seemingly disincentivizes that, it sort of seems to be clashing up against your idea a bit.
No, I get it. And look, the government had difficult decisions to make. Salary sacrifice absolutely will reduce incentives to save. We welcomed actually the fact that the timeline is 2029. You probably remember that there was some rumors that might be earlier than that. But if you zoom out for a second, pensions is a very sort of very broad landscape. And one of the things we're saying, auto-enrollment would actually make changes in the long run. And actually, a lot of the efforts that the government has put in place are to improve pension adequacy. And one of them, as you know, is the Pensions Commission that will report next year. So what I'm saying in the report this morning is that we encourage, I use Australia as an example, that we start progressively over time increasing that contributions from 8% today to 12%, which is what I'm suggesting
in
the report.
It's difficult to sell, though, isn't it? Especially when people, for example, have had their tax thresholds frozen. So we'll start to see more and more of their take-home pay, the pay that actually lands in their bank, going down, and this would do that again.
Well, if you see it, there's many ways to get there. But the suggestion I'm putting in the report this morning is that you increase the contribution of employers and employees over time. You'll see the one, there's many ways to do this, Will, but the way I'm suggesting is we over time increase first the employers, which I also appreciate is difficult, and then the employees have a much smaller increase later on. And we're saying this over 6 years. Yeah. And if you look at the example of Australia, they did this over a phased period, which exactly addresses your point, right? So we wouldn't do this today. So the cost of living crisis, a lot of pressure on businesses as well. What we're saying is this is over multiple parliaments to actually increase so that 10 years on the road, we look back, like Australia is doing right now, and saying this was really good for the economy.
And a very quick thought on planning too. Is the government going fast enough with that? You've got a lot about planning in this report.
Yeah, so actually the supply side reforms are one of the areas that I feel really strongly about. And then you see that of the six levers, if you read it, it's a 30-page report, really good read, by the way. the biggest lever is planning reforms. Yeah. I think what we now need is conviction, and we need the stability, and we need to. So is it going fast enough? I think what we now need, Will, is implementing what the government has already pushed forward, because we haven't seen any of the upside yet. And that's why we talk about this $220 billion impact. This is still to come.
Actions rather than just words. Antonio Samos, the Chief Executive of Legal & General, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Will. It's 23 minutes past seven. There may be a ban later this week on food producers using words like sausage and burger to describe items that are plant-based rather than made from meat. The European Commission is mulling over this change, which would make it actually illegal even if a prefix like vegetarian burger or vegan sausage was used. And we are, of course, outside the EU, but the standardisation of packaging for manufacturers means that there is a strong chance that it would be adopted here too. Richard McIlwain joins us, Chief Executive of the Vegetarian Society. Good morning.
Morning.
My first question, it might sound flippant, and I promise you it's genuinely not supposed to be, but why does it matter? Because the products would still exist, they would stay the same, it would be one word on the packaging. Why is that important?
There are two primary reasons. One is this policy is trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. So it's hardly evidence-based policymaking. The idea behind it is to reduce confusion in the marketplace. The idea that consumers are confused, they regularly buy, say, plant-based sausages rather than meat-based sausages. And yet there are any number of surveys going back over the last 5 years that show this simply isn't the case. In fact, the umbrella body for European consumer groups show that 80% of people across Europe are quite happy with meaty terms for plant-based products. And a YouGov survey last week showed that well over 90% of people in the UK had never bought a plant-based sausage, thinking it was a meat-based sausage. And the second reason, quite honestly, is because, particularly with flexitarians, people who are trying to cut down on meat, they need familiarity. Very often, they want to have something that tastes and feels like meat, but doesn't contain the meat for whatever reason, whether that's for health or for environment. And so they look for terms like burger or sausage or steak to guide them. These things are often sat in place, but plant-based sections in supermarkets as well. So it's actually very difficult to make a mistake. So it's actually trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist, could actually harm the growing plant-based industry, and would restrict choice and ease of choice for people who are trying to make different decisions with their diet, particularly those who are looking to cut down meat.
Would it harm the industry? Would somebody, if they could see a delicious, I don't know, mushroom-based sausage, and it was on the shelf, and if it didn't have the word sausage written on the packaging, would they look at it and think, oh, you know what, I don't fancy that anymore. I'm gonna go and get some meat instead. Would that happen?
Well, it could well do, couldn't it? I mean, what's it going to be called? A disc or a tube? I mean, it's absolutely nonsense.
I'm sure there'd be marketing people who would pick something slightly nicer than a disc or a tube.
You would hope, absolutely. The point is, why would those marketing people need to do this? There isn't a problem that exists. And that's my core point. This is actually more about protectionism. So this is the EU Commission being pushed by well-funded animal agriculture and meat lobbyists to protect animal agriculture and meat in the face of a growing plant-based industry. Of course, we've still got a climate crisis. We still have a biodiversity crisis. Millions and billions of pounds have been pumped into the plant-based sector. Not just that, but also now increasingly the cultivated meat sector, being able to grow meat from animal cells. So in the future, we may well be able to have our meat without the huge swathes of land that animal agriculture takes up. Now, clearly, for vested interests, that's a massive threat. And so what we contend is that this is simply about protecting the animal industry in Europe. And of course, as you said in your opener, the risk is very much because of alignment now with UK and EU on trade, that this will then come into the UK. And absolutely will harm and set back those plant-based businesses. I mean, we've had veggie burgers and sausages for 40 years. Nobody is confused about what if it's got veggie burger in front of it, buying it, thinking it's a meat-based burger. And the other thing is, how far does this go? Are people confused at hot dogs? They don't contain dog. Do people buy a beef tomato thinking it's got beef in it? Are we going to ban Glamorgan sausages? Because, of course, they're famously made with cheese.
These are big questions, Richard, for this time of the morning. They really are big existential questions for 7:27. Thank you for joining us, Richard McElwain, who's chief executive of the Vegetarian Society. Worth saying, by the way, we did ask the European Commission about this, about what their reasoning was for wanting to do it. They haven't got back to us on that just yet.
Cheese discs, veggie tubes.
Delicious. Sandwiches.
They're never going to catch up, are they? I don't think so. 28 minutes past 7. Here's Cathy.
Morning. A beaming champagne spraying Lando Norris is on the front and back page of almost every newspaper this morning after the British driver became Formula One world champion for the first time.
Thank you, guys. Oh, my God. You made a kid's dream come true. Thank you so much. I love you guys. Thanks for everything. You deserve it. I love you, Mum. I love you, Dad. Thanks for everything.
There's a little bit at the end of that I thought we'd hear where he says, I'm not crying, even though he clearly cried quite a lot yesterday. Very emotional. Let's speak to a man that's been on the inside at McLaren and knows Lando Norris very well, the former McLaren mechanic Mark Priestley. We can hear the emotion from Norris there. Part of the reason for that, I think, is that he's talked about winning the world title his way, Mark, and quote, not trying to be as aggressive as Max Verstappen or as forceful as other champions might have been in the past. How much does that tell us about his personality?
Yeah, good morning. It tells you a lot, and that is summing up his personality. You know, he's done this, as someone else rightly said yesterday, being a nice guy along the way. And that's not to say that Max isn't, because he really is, but I think in terms of the way he's approached not just this year, but his whole racing career, it's about doing things with an element of personality involved. He wears his heart on his sleeve. He's quite happy to really share his emotions, good and bad, across the course of a roller coaster of emotions throughout this season. And I think to have this accomplishment come at the end of a very, very long, very, very tough season where he's been pushed incredibly hard, you know, I think has captured the hearts of a nation a little bit, like in the way that it did with Lewis Hamilton all those years ago, which was the last time McLaren were able to secure this title.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, all of those aspects of it. And he has had to deal, as you mentioned, with a lot of pressure, particularly in the last few weeks. Max Verstappen has won the last three Formula One Grand Prix, including Abu Dhabi this weekend. How do you think Norris and McLaren have dealt with that pressure? Because there have been ups and downs, haven't there?
Yeah, they really have. And, none of the three contenders that were in for the title fight yesterday have been perfect this year. But then, of course, nobody ever is. I think that, you know, any championship, any title is always won over the culmination of an entirety of that season. And Formula One seasons now are very long. McLaren and Lando have done the best job over that season. No one's going to dispute that. But there's also been times when, whether it's the pressure or whether it's the stress and the sort of the difficulty of the challenge that came, has been a bit much. They've made mistakes, but so has Lando, so has Max Verstappen, so has Oscar Piastri. The team haven't been perfect, as I said. But you don't need to be perfect to win a title. You need to be better than the competition, and that's what he's been. And one thing I think he said yesterday, which was really important, kind of poignant and worth noting, is he says, because of the challenge from Max Verstappen and from his teammate Oscar Piastri, which was a real tough challenge, it pushed him into places that he's never really had to go before. He had to dig deeper than ever before. And you know, there was a point when he was more than 30 points behind the lead of this title race earlier in the season. He had to go away. He switched off things like social media. He made changes to his approach to the way he approached race weekends. And all of those little details in the background, working with his personal team, have enabled him to get on top of that pressure and come out on top. And I think he's got to be celebrated for that. Yeah. It's not just about the bit he does behind the wheel. There's a lot more to it.
There's a lot more to it in terms of what McLaren have been to him, supporting him. McLaren CEO Zak Brown started backing Norris on a management level when Norris was just 14. He's been through the junior ranks and he brought him into McLaren. What does it mean to McLaren now to win both these titles, the Constructors and the Drivers' Championships?
Yeah, it's huge. And, you know, I've been in a privileged position of being able to accomplish that with the team as well. But it was a long time ago. And it was 2008 with Lewis Hamilton when we last won a driver's title. A lot of people in this team have never experienced that until this weekend. It's such a big effort and such a big team effort. They call it the driver's title, but of course, it you know, you can't do it without this huge team of people. I always think about the moment yesterday in the Grand Prix when that pressure was at its highest. McLaren did two phenomenal pit stops at just over 2 seconds. The strategy's been excellent. You know, they got it together as a group, and that's what's got Lando there. So the celebration that we're all talking about for Lando, which is, of course, massive, is the same celebration, the same sense of pride that everyone in that McLaren organisation will feel this morning.
Yeah, Mark Priestley, thank you very much. Brilliant weekend for McLaren. And only a brief mention, England's men lost the second test against Australia by 8 wickets. They are 2-0 down in the 5-match Ashes series. We'll discuss that in the next hour.
Let's talk about the things we'll shall we? That's fun. Thank you, Cathy. More on that, as she says, in about an hour's time. Let's take a moment to look ahead to later this morning now on Radio 4.
Rocketing prices and rents, a new homes shortage, and an escalation of homelessness. How did the UK's housing crisis unfold, and can it be fixed? I'm Vicky Spratt, and in a new 3-part series, I'm travelling across Britain to find out. I'll speak to people at the sharp end of the problems, those who are supposed to be managing them, and those who have ideas about how to fix it. Housing Britain starts on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds this morning at 11.
What's the weather got in store for us? Well, dry and bright with patchy cloud over parts of southern England and Wales and showers over Scotland, wet and windy towards the evening. Now, coming up in our next half hour, a year after the fall of the Assad regime, how has life changed for ordinary Syrians? Jeremy Bowen will join us live from Damascus with his report. You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Nick Robinson at 26 minutes to 8. Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
Sir Keir Starmer will host President Zelensky at Downing Street later for talks with the German Chancellor and the French President on the US-drafted proposal to end the war in Ukraine. Donald Trump has expressed fresh frustration with Mr. Zelensky after days of high-level discussions between the US and Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky said the talks hadn't been easy. The head of the Royal Navy is expected to outline how the UK plans to respond to the threats Russia poses to undersea cables and pipelines. Over the past 2 years, there's been increased activity by Russian vessels operating close to the UK's underwater infrastructure. The Prime Minister is to announce plans to create 50,000 new apprenticeships in England, targeting sectors including AI, hospitality and engineering. The £725 million project aims to reverse the long-term decline of the number of young people starting apprenticeships. This has fallen by 40% during the past decade. Thailand says its air force has bombed military positions inside Cambodia after armed clashes along their disputed border. A Thai soldier has been killed. It's the most serious confrontation between the two countries since they agreed to an American-backed ceasefire in July. Nigerian media are reporting that security forces have freed 100 children kidnapped from a Catholic boarding school. More than 2 weeks ago, gunmen stormed the school in a remote community in Niger State, abducting more than 300 pupils and 12 members of staff. Just under 32% of voters took part in yesterday's elections in Hong Kong, despite a campaign by the pro-Beijing government urging people to vote. The figure was up marginally compared with a record low in 2021 after the electoral system was overhauled. A water leak at the Louvre Museum in Paris has damaged hundreds of books. It took place late last month in the Egyptian department. The items will be dried, sent to a bookbinder and restored before being returned to the shelves.
Thank you, Caroline. It is now 24 minutes to 8 o'clock. Today marks a year since the fall of the Assad regime in Damascus and the arrival of a new leader of Syria, Ahmed al-Sharaa, who was labelled a terrorist by the United States when he rose to power, but has now been welcomed in the White House by Donald Trump. It is an extraordinary transformation after more than a half century of the Assad family ruling Syria with an iron fist, persecuting, torturing, imprisoning their opponents. Our international editor, Jerry Boone, has gone back to Damascus to imagine, to examine life in Syria 1 year on, and joins us now. Morning to you, Jeremy. They will welcome, no doubt, the fall of the Assads a year on, but has life really improved for ordinary Syrians?
Well, it's improved in one massive way, Nick, and a lot of Syrians will say this to you. There are no Assads. That is something that is, you know, such a change, because...
We seem to have
lost Jeremy. It wasn't just Jeremy, Bashar al-Assad. It was.
Could you just pick up from the beginning, if you could, again, Jeremy? We just lost your line. I tell you what we'll do is we'll play Jeremy's report, and if we can get him back afterwards on a better line, we will. This is Jeremy Byrne reporting now on 1 year on from the fall of the Assad regime from Damascus.
They're fireworks, though it sounds a bit like the war that used to shake the city when rebels who held the suburbs were trying to break into the centre of Damascus. They're celebrating because it's exactly a year since the fall of Bashar al-Assad, the man who broke Syria to try to save the regime he inherited from his father. I've been to Douma, one of those suburbs, when the regime, helped by the Russians, finally forced the surrender of the rebels in the suburbs in 2018, it looked as if Assad was winning. Ahmed Ashara, who overthrew him 12 months ago, had other ideas. Just walking around this area, it's still immensely badly damaged. You know, it's been years since there were airstrikes here, but very little's been done to fix it up. You can see signs. People have moved into some flats. There are little brick walls that have been built, walls made of breeze blocks to block up shell holes. Signs of progress. There's so much they have to do. We drove south from Damascus to Deraa, the town on the border with Jordan where the uprising against the Assad regime started in 2011. A few enterprising families have clearly been rebuilding their homes, but the vast majority of houses here are still absolutely destroyed, just concrete skeletons. One of Syria's biggest problems, the government says it, the UN says it, is the fact the economy is in such a bad state. It's hard to get economic activity going again in places like this if there are unexploded bombs, unexploded munitions around in the ruins, in the concrete. So that's another reason, apart from just purely safety, why it's important to try and clean these places up.
My name is Piers Brecker. I'm the location manager for the Halo Trust here.
So just across the road from us, there are a combination of submunitions, anti-personnel mines and anti-tank mines. Next to that, we found a 122mm Grad rockets warhead.
So pretty much, you name it, it's here.
You name it, it's here.
To get rid of it, they place a small explosive charge and from a safe distance, blow it up. A local man has seen the demining team here, and he said there are some very suspicious objects at his property, so we're going to check it out. So the shepherd here, Suleiman Kana, he's got his three boys, and they are all bearing the marks of war. They've all at different times been hurt. He was shot. He's showing me a huge scar on his leg where he was shot through the right calf. And the boys themselves, they're all bearing marks of where they've been injured by explosions, and also one of them, Ali, is coughing badly. His lungs have been damaged, I think, by smoke he's inhaled from munitions that they were burning off. The boy's father was relieved that the lethal litter left behind by the war was finally being cleared.
Life is very, very difficult. There's no mercy and comfort in it. My kids were burned twice by gunpowder. This one's face was burned. Look, this one's legs were burned.
Every stop in Syria illustrates another challenge to the new government. We moved on to Beitjin, a village in the foothills of the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, where the problem is Israel. It's in the area Israel is demanding is demilitarized, where the IDF seized more Syrian land after Assad fell. We were in Beitjin 3 days after the IDF killed 13 residents of the village in a raid Israel said was an arrest operation. The Damascus government calls it a war crime. Six IDF soldiers were wounded when local men fought back, forcing a hasty retreat.
So this is from the attack, right? He's pointing up at a damaged building full of bullet holes. We're being given a tour of Beijing by Hamid Kamal. He describes himself as a 38-year-old shepherd, like a lot of the guys around here. He wears sort of olive khaki-type clothing. This village, Beijing, is right under the eyes of the Israeli observation posts in the Golan Heights. These people have lived very close to the IDF for many, many years, actually.
Car pulled up. Halil Abu Daha was in the passenger seat, his arm in plaster, coming home from the hospital where he'd been treated since the IDF raid.
I was in my house with my children. We were trying to find a safe place. They shot at my two daughters. One was hit and the other died instantly. When I picked her up, I was shot in the hand.
At their home, Huda, age 9, was lying under a blanket recovering from a bullet wound. Her sister, Hiba, 17, was shot dead. Their mother, Mohammed, is in despair.
We want to live in our homes, and we want clinic and medical staff, because we don't have one. Our children are living in hell here. There is no safety for them. We go to sleep and wake up afraid.
In the village, neighbours and VIPs were arriving to offer their sympathy and express anger at Israel. It's 3 days after the Israeli attack, a significant day in the mourning process. It seems to me these are villagers who have just been buffeted and trapped by circumstances, the uprising against Assad, the war, unable to control their own lives. And a year on from the fall of Assad, that hasn't changed. It's simply that the forces gripping their lives have changed. The reality of how they live hasn't.
In Damascus, and I'm pleased to say we've got our international editor back on a better line. Listening to your report, Jeremy, it makes sense of a conclusion reached over the weekend by the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Syria, who described the country as fragile. Do you agree with that assessment? And are they still, as you began to say before the line went, still happy to see the Assad's gone?
Yeah, I think they are. Yeah, I'm sorry I disappeared like that. I think that's the thing about Syrians is that first, apart from, of course, a small group of people who are benefiting from the regime who are pretty fearful now, most people are just totally relieved that the Assads aren't here because they were such a looming presence for such a long time and a savage presence as well. You know, thousands of people disappearing, being killed in their penal system. The issues, you know, as you heard there, economy is still pretty bad, though it might be getting better in some places. It hasn't really percolated through into people's lives yet. Trying to unify a country with minorities who do not trust the center, that's very difficult. There's been sectarian killing. This place of transitional justice is really slow in terms of... So people are taking things into their own hands. There are quite a lot of revenge attacks in different places. Unexploded weapons around the place, killing people. You know, you name it. And you can't be unsurprised by that. After 50 years of dictatorship and 14 years of war, it was never going to be a cakewalk. I think from the government's point of view, from Sharaa's point of view, he's done really well abroad. He's convinced a lot of people that he really is the best bet for Syria, the Saudis, the Americans, the Brits, various others. I think here in Syria, people are a little bit more skeptical because they realize the extent of the problems that he faces. And I think one really big question is this, and that is, have they managed to get enough stability in the country right now where if they had a major crisis, and what I'm talking about is another big burst of sectarian violence like they saw in the summer with the Druze minority in the south, or what if there was a jihadi-sponsored major assassination or bomb attack, perhaps in the middle of Damascus? These things are, you know, realistic threats. Is the new administration able to ride out something like that and emerge on the other side? And it's frankly not really clear. So they are, I think, going from week to week, and that's the big challenge.
Jeremy Bowen in Damascus, thank you.
It is 13 minutes to 8 now, and time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning is the Reverend David Wilkinson, Professor of Theology and Religion at St John's College, Durham University.
Good morning. In the midst of despair for many at the lack of international progress on combating climate change comes a small but significant story of hope. Last week, scientists from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration published measurements of this year's ozone hole over Antarctica. It showed the hole continuing to shrink, demonstrating that the ozone layer is recovering. This is a glimmer of hope, giving confidence that science and governments can combine in healing the world. 40 years ago, scientists from the British Antarctic Survey first observed this hole caused by the release of chlorofluorocarbons into the atmosphere, chemicals used in a wide range of goods from refrigerators to hairspray. The erosion of the ozone layer exposes the Earth to dangerous levels of ultraviolet radiation. Governments moved swiftly, and 2 years later, they adopted the Montreal Protocol. This led to a curtailing of these chemicals, even if their concentration in the atmosphere would reach their peak some 13 years later. But the protocol, built on good science and political willpower, means that by the 2060s, the ozone hole will be closed and the planet protected. This achievement needed committed action and long-term vision to solve a problem over many decades. Sir John Horton, a leading atmospheric physicist, subsequently chaired over 100 international scientists in producing the first scientific assessment report as part of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. In contrast to the Montreal Protocol, combating wider global warming was and still is slow progress, resisting considerable pressure from some governments and fossil fuel advocates. When asked whether he ever despaired, his reply was, "Absolutely not. It's a totally solvable problem." This was based in his confidence in science, but also in his deep Christian faith that God was active in the world and had not given up on it. For Christians, the Creator God becoming flesh and blood in the baby born in Bethlehem is an embodiment of hope. This incarnation shows that God is committed long-term to the physical world in both the healing of human beings and the environment, and that science is a gift to contribute to that. Further, the good news of Jesus is that love can change people from selfish greed to generous service. In a complex world where problems seem so intractable, I'm thankful for glimmers of hope, either from science or from the Advent story, to sustain action over the long term and to resist the darkness of despair.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend David Wilkinson. It is now 10 to 8.
The government is announcing new money for apprenticeships this morning, aiming to reverse a decline in the number of young people who are taking them up. Well, Baroness Smith is the Minister for Skills, and I asked her a bit more about how it will be paid for, in particular the concerns from bigger businesses who will pay for this, that changes to the apprenticeship levy that were announced in the budget will make it less efficient.
The real priority for us with apprenticeships is to put right what we've seen over the last 10 years, which is a reduction of 40% in young people starting apprenticeships. Apprenticeships which can really set you on the route to a high-skilled job and the sort of earnings that and the sort of jobs that young people want. So we are making a determined shift of apprenticeship training back towards young people again. We're making it, we're fully funding apprenticeship training for young people in small and medium-sized businesses, unlike previously. And we are reforming the rest of the apprenticeship system so that, for example, we can offer short courses for adults. That's something that employers have said they want the flexibility to be able to do.
But what about those details that are causing concern? Because if things like the apprenticeship levy aren't right, then this will not be an effective policy.
Well, exactly right, which is why we need to reform the way in which it's operating so that we can ensure that we're getting the sort of maximum opportunities for young people. We're able to introduce these new short courses. That's why we're working already with business on how we can support businesses to be able to offer more apprenticeships, how we can make the apprenticeship levy system more transparent so that businesses actually know what they've got available to spend, so that we can make it sustainable for the long term. Because we have invested an additional £725 million over the coming years, but we want to be able to use that to grow apprenticeships for young people, to introduce more flexibility. That's why we want to look at the way that the levy is working, and we'll be doing that absolutely alongside employers. I was talking to employers just last week about exactly how we're going to be doing that, and we're open to the concerns that employers have and how we actually deliver it.
Is this growth fast enough? Because last year there were more than 350,000 apprenticeship starts. Your announcement will create 50,000 more apprenticeships across the next 3 years. That's a drop in the ocean, really.
Well, there were more apprenticeships this year than last year, which is good. But what we have seen is a real decline in the numbers of young people able to start apprenticeships. That's why we're making this shift to support young people at the beginning of their careers.
But 50,000 over 3 years is tiny.
That's what this investment will help us to deliver. We've made other changes to the apprenticeship system as well that will help to get more people through their apprenticeship. So, for example, removing some of the conditions around separate English and maths exams for adult apprentices, helping to streamline the way in which employers do the bureaucracy, the paperwork around apprenticeships, helping to make sure that there is more flexibility for what you can spend your apprenticeship levy on, as I say, so that there are more employers who can invest in short courses to upskill their work. Workforce.
There's an interesting story on the front page of the Times this morning that Labour Together, which is the think tank very influential at Ran Sakir Starmer's leadership campaign, is canvassing party members on who should replace him. It sent out a survey. It's got a list of names. Succession planning, always important. Of course it is. But right now, is there anything wise about that timing?
look, if Labour Together asked me to do their survey, I shall say Keir Starmer's in the job. He's doing a good job, and that's who I will be supporting. He's off today to McLaren to congratulate them, I suspect, on their double championship in the F1 championships, but also to talk to them about the apprentices that they're taking on and the opportunities that they're providing.
I appreciate Jackie Smith. You're trying to move away a little, but it's not the sort of conversation that you want to happen now, is it?
Well, what I'm doing, and probably showing a certain element of frustration, is focus on the things that actually will make a difference for people today, and that is whether or not we can get more young people into apprenticeships. But this
isn't coming from your detractors, your critics. This is coming from Labour Together. This is coming from within.
Yeah, and they're doing a very wide-ranging survey, and this is one of the questions that they are asking. The point for me is my responsibility is to focus on the nearly 1 million young people who are neither earning nor learning. It's to focus on the young people sitting there this morning thinking, do you know what, I really want to work for McLaren and in that sort of advanced manufacturing. I really want to have the opportunity to think about how AI is going to affect the workplace. I want to just get a start in the workplace. So perhaps I want a new foundation apprenticeship, one of the ones that we're expanding today. That's really what I'm spending my time thinking about today.
Baroness Smith, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, is back with us. Henry, that is a salient point. The timing of something like this, when so much is swirling around, is a little awkward, is it not?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And worth remembering that Labour Together is a think tank that played a huge role in propelling Sir Keir Starmer to the Labour leadership nearly 6 years ago. It was for a long time run by Morgan McSweeney, who's now Sir Keir Starmer's chief of staff. So these aren't the kinds of questions that you want your friends to be asking if you are the Labour leader, if you are the Prime Minister. And I do think it does speak to what is the undercurrent, or perhaps just the current, of conversation in the Labour Party at the moment. I mean, perhaps the most frequent question that gets asked in conversations with Labour MPs and government ministers, including quite senior ones at the moment, is before May or after May, which is to say, when do you think Sir Keir Starmer is going to be challenged? Will it be before the local and national elections in May or afterwards? Now, it is worth remembering, especially when you're speaking to someone like Jackie Smith, who was a cabinet minister under Gordon Brown. Well, you know, there have been previous Labour leaders who have been assailed from all sides over their leadership for some time, but managed to see off those challenges and last quite a lot longer than people necessarily expected them to. But there is an increasing question within the Labour Party about when that challenge will come. We know that there are those around Sir Keir Starmer who think that that challenge is going to come and that it is all but inevitable, because that was the subject of that extraordinary briefing that ended up clearly backfiring just a few weeks ago concerning Wes Streeting.
Henry Zeffman, thank you.
Let's look ahead to what you can look forward to here on Radio 4 and indeed on BBC Sounds, because Nuala McGovern's joining us, but not with news of today's Woman's Hour, but with news of what, Nuala?
Send in the Spotlight. It's a new podcast and it wants to reimagine support for special educational needs. So the current system is widely considered to be broken. There's a big increase in demand. It's outstripping supply. And there are so many children that are left without the support they need, or that they have to go to school far away from home. So in our first episode, it's out right now, the School Standards Minister, Georgia Gould, she tells me about her plan to listen to those affected by the crisis and answers questions and criticism over reform delays. Plus, we have Send Parents, the actors, Kelly Bright and Anna Maxwell-Martin with me. It's called Send in the Spotlight. You can search for it now on BBC Sounds. Subscribe. And I look forward to you joining me.
Oh, it sounds really, it's something we talk about a lot, so it's good to hear it in depth. Thank you, Nuala, for joining us. Let's get the weather as well. Here's Simon King.
Anna, thanks so much indeed. Good morning. Some pretty unsettled weather for the week ahead, particularly for Tuesday into Wednesday, where we could see some severe gales and some pretty stormy weather, especially to the northwest of the UK. So that's one to watch. But for today, across parts of England and Wales, we've got some showers around, especially around some southern areas. It'll stay fairly cloudy, I think, across southern England into the afternoon. There will be some rain at times as well with that, especially around the English Channel coasts. But further north, across Wales, the Midlands, eastern England, here we will see at least some bright or sunny spells for a time before the cloud thickens up with a few showers into the afternoon. And across northern areas of England, that's where we'll probably see the sunshine lasting for longest this afternoon. Quite breezy, but mild. Temperatures about 11 to 14 degrees. Now for Scotland, we've got some pretty heavy rain at the moment, moving its way northward. It'll tend to break up in northern Scotland this afternoon with showers. We'll see some showers also around western areas, but some sunny spells elsewhere, highs of 7 to 10 degrees. And for Northern Ireland today, sunny spells through this morning, showers moving in through the afternoon, top temperatures of 9 to 11 degrees. But through tonight, it turns very wet across the UK. A strengthening wind, as I said, going into Tuesday. So stay tuned.
Simon, we will. Thank you for joining us with that. You're listening to Today on Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Monday the 8th of December. The headlines this morning: President Zelensky is to join the Prime Minister and the leaders of France and Germany in Downing Street later to discuss the US plan to bring peace to Ukraine. But Donald Trump has accused Mr. Zelensky of not reading the proposal. The meeting comes as the Kremlin's welcomed the new US national security strategy, which is sharply critical of Europe. We'll hear from President Trump's former ambassador to the EU at 10 past 8.
In Donald Trump's worldview, the United States' interests are furthered by having a more conservative Europe. Period. Full stop.
The government is planning to create 50,000 new apprenticeships in England as it tries to tackle a fall in the number of young people starting placements. And tens of thousands of people in Thailand and Cambodia have been ordered to evacuate because of renewed fighting between the two countries.
Also in the next hour, one of the giants of British post-war photography, Martin Parr, has died at the age of 73. His friends, Grayson Perry and Wendy Jones, will join us to reflect on the power of his work. And
Lando, this is Zach from McLaren. Is this the world champion hotline?
Yeah.
You did it! You did it! Awesome!
Woo! Thank you, guys. Oh, my God.
That's how it feels to become a Formula One champion. Lando Norris was in tears as he joined the ranks of the greats in Abu Dhabi. Damon Hill is another name on the list. We'll talk to him about how it feels to reach the pinnacle of your sport. That's all off the BBC News, read for us this morning by Caroline Nichols.
President Zelensky will be welcomed to Downing Street by Sir Keir Starmer today for talks on the American proposal to end the war between Ukraine and Russia. They'll be joined by the French and German leaders as European powers try to make sure that Kyiv receives security guarantees if there's a ceasefire. Donald Trump has expressed fresh frustration with Mr. Zelensky after days of high-level discussions between the US and Ukraine. Mr. Zelensky said the talks hadn't been easy. Our correspondent Joel Gunter reports from Kyiv.
President Zelensky will be looking to shore up military and security support as he meets Sir Keir Starmer and other European leaders at a pivotal moment for peace talks. Mr. Zelensky's visit follows days of difficult negotiations between Ukraine and the US in Florida, as well as heavy Russian airstrikes in recent nights against Ukrainian infrastructure. And now, just hours ahead of the meeting, criticism from Donald Trump, who accused the Ukrainian leader of failing to read the latest peace plan.
Russia is, I believe, fine with it, but I'm not sure that Zelensky is fine with it. His people love it, but he hasn't read it.
Mr. Trump seems to have been referring to a statement from Mr. Zelensky last night in which the Ukrainian leader said he was waiting for a full briefing from his negotiating team. In reality, there is deep disquiet among Ukrainians about Russia's demands, particularly for territory it has so far failed to capture on the battlefield. In eastern Ukraine, fighting rages around the key city of Pokrovsk, and Russian airstrikes have left residents here facing severe power and heating shortages as they head into the depths of winter.
Ivana Klimpush-Tsintsadze is the chair of the Parliamentary Committee on the Integration of Ukraine to the EU. She told us all European countries need to be more vocal about America's push for peace.
Vis-a-vis American partners, as they pretend to continue being the neutral moderator, but at the same time, it seems that they are getting more and more on the side of the aggressor of the Russian Federation, trying to push Ukraine and Europe into something that is called peace, but which will not lead to lasting and sustainable peace on this continent.
The head of the Royal Navy is expected to set out how the UK plans to tackle the threat from Russia to undersea cables and pipelines after increased activity by Russian ships during the past 2 years. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
The government says the threat posed by Russia to the UK's underwater infrastructure is real and needs to be confronted. Last month, a suspected Russian spy ship, the Yantar, pointed lasers at RAF pilots tracking its movement close to UK waters. The Navy is developing an initiative known as Atlantic Bastion, a network combining existing ships, submarines and aircraft with a new generation of unmanned vessels and drones. The aim is to identify and confront threats more quickly than before. Skeptics say the Navy lacks the resources to do the job properly. The First Sea Lord, General Sir Gwyn Jenkins, says a revolutionary underwater network is taking shape. He'll be setting out his vision for the future of the Royal Navy in a speech later today.
The Prime Minister is to announce £725 million of funding to create 50,000 new apprenticeships in England. Some will be in sectors including AI, hospitality and engineering. The government wants to reverse a 40% fall in the number of young people starting apprenticeships over the past decade. Our political correspondent Harry Farley reports.
Sir Keir Starmer will visit a McLaren centre today, perhaps hoping some of the team's Formula One success will rub off. The company uses apprenticeships, which the Prime Minister has said he wants treated with the same respect as degree courses. But there has been a sharp decline in young people starting apprenticeships during the last decade. And the nearly 1 million young people out of work, education or training is a big political challenge. The funding, paid for by larger companies and wider taxes, is part of a package aimed at tackling that. The money will cover the cost of some apprenticeships for under 25s in small and medium-sized businesses.
Baroness Smith, the Minister for Skills, told this programme the government is committed to making apprenticeships work for businesses and young people.
We're working already with business on how we can support businesses to be able to offer more apprenticeships, how we can make the apprenticeship levy system more transparent so that businesses actually know what they've got available to spend, so that we can make it sustainable for the long term.
Thailand says its air force has bombed military positions inside Cambodia after armed clashes along their disputed border. A Thai soldier has been killed. This is the most serious confrontation between the two countries since they signed a ceasefire in July, which was backed by Donald Trump. From Bangkok, our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head reports.
Tens of thousands of people in Thailand are once again being moved to temporary shelters as the Thai military reports multiple rockets being fired from the Cambodian side this morning, a weapon which has not been used since a ceasefire was agreed in July. An armed forces spokesman said Thai Air Force jets had bombed Cambodian military positions after a Thai soldier was killed in an exchange of fire on the disputed border. A Cambodian military spokeswoman has accused the Thai army of opening fire first and insisted that the Cambodian government still stood by the peace agreement signed in October in the presence of President Trump.
Nigerian media are reporting that security forces have freed 100 children who were kidnapped from a Catholic boarding school. More than 2 weeks ago, gunmen stormed the school in a remote community in Niger State, abducting more than 300 pupils and 12 members of staff. From Abuja, Medina Maishonu reports.
The abduction of more than 300 children from St. Mary's Catholic boarding school in Niger State was one of the country's worst mass kidnappings. The Christian Association of Nigeria in Niger State and its Commissioner of Police say they've now received confirmation that 100 students have been rescued by security forces. They said the National Security Advisor's Office told them the children would be released in groups to their parents starting from today. It still isn't clear who is behind this kidnapping, which has shone a spotlight on the country's security situation.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that the second phase of a US plan to end the war in Gaza is close, but key issues need to be resolved. With questions outstanding over how to disarm Hamas, one of its senior officials has suggested his group is very open-minded about how to deal with its remaining weapons. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Yolan Nell.
Hamas has still to hand back the body of one Israeli hostage as part of the initial stage of the Gaza ceasefire plan. Mr. Netanyahu said that he'd hold important discussions with President Trump at the end of the month on how to ensure the plan's second stage was achieved. He voiced skepticism to Israeli diplomats about whether a planned international force could successfully disarm Hamas, but pledged that would happen. Speaking to the Associated Press, a top Hamas official, Bassem Naim, said his group was ready for talks on freezing or storing its weapons in a possible approach to one of the thorniest issues ahead.
The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, is expected to put pressure on the government to speed up the process of establishing a national inquiry into grooming gangs. It's thought she'll outline proposed terms of reference for the inquiry, drawn up with the help of some survivors of abuse. Labour said it was determined to deliver justice for the victims of grooming gangs. The Shadow Home Secretary, Chris Philp, told us the government had taken too long to make progress.
They never wanted to have this inquiry in the first place. They were dragged kicking and screaming. Here we are, half a year later, and they have done basically nothing. And their failure makes them complicit in the cover-up of these appalling crimes. We think they need to get on with it. They need to appoint a judge to chair this inquiry.
The parents of the three girls killed in the Southport attack in July 2024 have told the BBC how they've supported each other to help them through their grief. During interviews for a special documentary, the parents of Alice De Silva Aguirre, Elsie Dot Stancombe and BB King describe how they've set up charitable projects in their children's names. The organisations offer support and creative opportunities for young people. Sarah Campbell reports.
Alice was 9 years old, Elsie seven and BB six when they were killed while attending a Taylor Swift-themed dance class. Their names and photos have since become widely known as the victims of one of the most shocking crimes in recent years. But their parents are determined to create legacies which reflect who their daughters were. Jenny Stancombe is Elsie's mum.
We all have the same goal, in a sense, to ensure that our girls aren't remembered for this, that they will live on longer than we do.
The three families have established charities and foundations which aim to help other children and young people in their daughters' names.
You can see Our Girls, the Southport Families, on BBC One and iPlayer at 8 o'clock tomorrow evening.
Thank you, Caroline. It is now 11 minutes past 8. Why is the United States attacking its allies and giving comfort to its enemies? And what that might that lead Donald Trump to do next as he seeks to end the war in Ukraine? Those are the questions which hang over today's meeting in Downing Street of Ukraine's President Zelensky with the Prime Minister, President Macron of France and Chancellor Merz of Germany. The new US national security strategy not only declares that Europe has unrealistic expectations for the war, it also condemns the EU for migration policies, which it says raise, quotes, the real prospect of civilizational erasure, as some NATO countries are, it claims, on course to become, quotes, majority non-European. The document also accuses European governments of undermining political liberty and sovereignty, suppressing political opposition, censoring free speech, as last night Elon Musk went to war with the EU, having been threatened with a €120 million fine for the behaviour of his company X. He's calling for the abolition of the EU and tweeted an image of the European flag combined with the Nazi swastika. The former NATO Secretary General Lord Robertson called the new US strategy very disappointing and alarming to the West. Here he is speaking last night to the BBC's Westminster Hour.
It was very disappointing and in many ways alarming to the West. It marks an America going back to insular and isolationist politics, which hasn't worked for them in the past at all. It marginalises the NATO alliance. It calls on it to stop enlarging further. It sees Russia not as a threat. It's harsh on Europe and makes commentary on internal European politics. All in all, this is not a good strategy to come out of the United States. And we'll see whether the rest of the American establishment follows on it.
Lord Robertson's view there, the former Secretary General of NATO. Well, what is the United States view, or the view of those, at least, who admire Donald Trump? I've been speaking to his former ambassador to the EU, Ambassador Gordon Sondland, and I asked him why Europeans shouldn't feel alarmed by a document that appears to talk as if it's we're who are the enemy.
Well, I think that was the purpose of the document, was to get them to feel a bit alarmed. Europe needs to take the lead in this entire matter. The United States can back up, the United States can support, but it's really Europe that needs to be out front. And that is really where Donald Trump is going here, because he understands that if we conduct business as usual, the way we've conducted business vis-a-vis Russia for the last, say, 30 years, it would be the United States that would be directly engaging with Russia, trying to resolve this, making whatever threats are necessary to Putin to get him to back down. And were he not to accede to our demands, we would be the ones in a conflict and Europe would be watching. And that's not what Trump wants to do this time.
So when this national security document states, and I quote, that Europe has unrealistic expectations for the war, what does that mean? Does it mean that it is unrealistic for Putin to lose this war?
It is unrealistic for Putin to lose the war in the conventional sense. The war should have never began. Putin is absolutely the invader. Europe allowed this to happen in 2014. Europe allowed it to happen again when the troops and arms were massing on the Ukrainian border. And at this point, we're now in the conflict. And basically, Russia is going to need to get something to stop. Do I think they should get something? Absolutely not. But that is not realistic today.
Ah, but isn't it also unrealistic to assume that if Putin does get something, he won't come back for more? He may invade Ukraine again. He may invade another European state. He may simply seek to intimidate countries on his border until they deliver governments that are acceptable to the Kremlin.
You're 100% correct. He will try again unless Europe finally steps up and creates a major roadblock for him in terms of its defense spending, in terms of its own commitment of materiel and personnel, to make it clear that Europe is willing to get into that kind of a war with Putin, backed by the United States, but not led by the United States. That's where Trump is going here.
But he also seems to be going in the direction of supporting not European governments, but parties that are often described as being on the far right. This document that has come out, the National Security Strategy from the United States, warns that Europe faces, quotes, civilization erasure, and promises to support extreme parties against the parties that are currently in government. Why so?
I think Trump is trying to support governments and politicians that see the world the way he does.
Even if those are parties in Germany that are designated by their own intelligence agencies to be neo-Nazis.
Donald Trump is not a fascist, and Donald Trump is not a Nazi. He isn't. I worked directly with him for several years. His children are Jewish. His grandchildren are Jewish. He is not a Nazi. What he's looking for people that believe in strong borders, that believe in assimilation when people immigrate to your country legally. A lot of the same principles that apply here in the United States. That's the direction he'd like to see Europe go.
But it's not the job of an American president to tell European who they should vote for, is it?
It's not a question of whether it's his job. It's a question of his perspective. And he's more than able and should be more than able to voice his perspective, very much the way Europeans, by the way, voice their perspective when there's an election going on in the United States. They would have much rather seen Kamala Harris win than Donald Trump. And that was very clear throughout the entire race when interviews were conducted throughout the continent.
He doesn't just voice his perspective, though, does he, Ambassador? This document talks about helping Europe correct its current trajectory. And the document complains about what it calls the censorship of free speech and the suppression of political opposition.
Well, in Donald Trump's worldview, the United States interests, and again, I'm speaking through his eyes and through his mind, the United States interests are furthered by having a more conservative Europe, period, full stop.
And what about censorship? Why this obsession?
Well, look at the recent kerfuffle over the fine that was leveled at X, at the former Twitter. I believe it's 140 million euro. The bureaucrats in Brussels are playing with Elon Musk. They don't like him. And it really, really reflects poorly on their view toward the United States.
I think this in Brussels they might call it the law, Ambassador, wouldn't they?
Yeah, check marks on a verification. Come on.
The historian Simon Sharma, who is a great student of United States history, a lover, I think it's fair to say, of the United States, says the historian in me knows that the Trump national security document will go down as one of the great betrayals of the free world on all those responsible for it, remembered in shameful ignominy.
Well, that's very profound, but I think it'll go down as one of the great wake-up calls in the free world. And it's time that Europe sat up out of bed, shook its head vigorously, and began to take leadership again in its own defense, rearming itself and reinvigorating its defense so that Putin doesn't even think about going any further.
Ambassador Gordon Sondland there, the former US ambassador to the European Union. Listening to that is the former national security advisor in this country under both David Cameron and Theresa May when they were in 10 Downing Street, Sir Mark Lyle Grant. Good morning to you, Sir Mark. Absolutely clear, the ambassador, wasn't it? It's meant to shock you, this document. It's meant to upset you. It's meant to be a wake-up call.
Yes, I think if the purpose was to set Europe alarmed, it's probably been successful. You know, it is a remarkable document, and it is such a 180-degree contrast to the Biden national security strategy of 2022, because he talked about, you know, competition between democracy and autocracy, building alliances, multilateralism, climate change, outcompeting China, constraining Russia. And this is the complete opposite. This is a reassertion of the Monroe Doctrine with the so-called Trump corollary based on America first, American preeminence and power in the Western Hemisphere, and letting governments do whatever they like all around the world, except in Europe, where America is actually saying, actually, we want to course correct where the trajectory of European politics is going. So it is a very, very sharp shift from 3 years ago.
The question then is what it means for this meeting in London of Zelensky with the three European leaders, with Starmer, Macron and Merz. Does it change anything, or does it merely confirm what we knew, which is Donald Trump believes, as we were just hearing that interview, that if you're going to do a deal with Putin, he's going to have to get something out of it?
Yes, I think the Americans have reached a situation now that they just want a deal, and they're not too fussed about what that deal means, provided that America gets some economic benefit out of it. That is the approach that the Trump administration takes to a lot of its conflict resolution efforts. But I think from the European point of view, they will stick to the position that it is up to President Zelensky to decide what is acceptable on the question of territorial concessions or the future of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant, for instance, which is two outstanding issues. And for the Europeans, the key for them is that when the fighting does come to an end, as it no doubt will soon, that there are guarantees that prevent Russia coming back for more, and that Ukraine is left with a sustainable sovereign country that is free to choose its own future path. Those are the key strategic points for the Europeans, and I'm sure they'll be reaffirmed in the meeting today.
But does it mean that we've reached a stage where, in private, deniably perhaps, European leaders may want to say to Zelensky, look, you're going to have to look forward to a day in which, yes, we fight for you to get the guarantees you've talked of, Sir Mark, and we ensure your sovereignty, but you're going to have to give up quite a lot of territory?
I think Zelensky recognises that he's not going to get back, in practice, if not in law, all the territories that the Russians are occupied. But I don't think any of the Europeans are going to be pushing Zelensky into accepting a deal that he can't sell to the Ukrainians, because that will not end up in any sustainable peace process, and that's going to be bad for European security. So yes, they'll want Zelensky to be realistic, and I think he recognises the need to be realistic, but I don't think they're going to be working on behalf of the Americans to push Zelensky into a deal that he can't accept.
Sir Mark Lyle-Grant, former National Security Advisor, thank you for joining us.
It's 23 minutes past eight now. The photographer Martin Parr, whose colourful and carefully observed photos captured British life for decades, has died at the age of 73. He was last on this programme back in March, and he was talking about The Last Resort, that seminal series of images that captured holidaymakers on Merseyside.
Well, when I moved from black and white to colour in 1982 and started photographing in New Brighton, which is quite a shabby seaside resort, but still had lots of day visitors there, I think it's these pictures that people thought were, you know, very difficult to handle. You know, I got a lot of controversy then. They were shown initially in Liverpool and no one batted an eyelid because everyone knows what New Brighton's like. When those images went down to the Serpentine, that's when, you know, I got some very negative feedback. It's the contrast between the litter-strewn beach and the families still going out there having a day trip. That was the whole point of the exercise. And this is in the 80s during the time of Mrs. Thatcher, and it really was, you know, quite political to sort of say, look at this. And people down in the southeast and in London just had no idea what Liverpool or other cities like that were actually like.
Well, joining us to reflect on Martin Parr's life and his work are his friends, the artist Grayson Perry and biographer Wendy Jones. Good morning, both.
Good morning.
Morning.
Grayson, I think those images that we heard Martin so beautifully describe there, they would have been very different taken by somebody else, somebody without that eye for humanity that Martin had.
Yeah, I mean, I think he got a lot of flack because people were projecting their own snobbery onto the photographs. And they were, of course, were probably his most famous images that he's took. But he had, you know, such a history. You know, his early work was so elegiac and his later work was such fun. You know, I think that they sometimes have got in the way of his huge body of work. But he was often accused of being the kind of white middle class man looking at the sort of diverse world. But I think that he just took what he saw, and he was amazingly inclusive in what he took. You know, there isn't a corner of Britain or a community in Britain that he didn't record. He was our national photographer in many ways.
Wendy, you were telling me, and I didn't realise this, that he was enormously famous in other countries to the point where people would come up to him in the street.
Yes, he couldn't walk down the street or go to a restaurant in France without people coming and asking for his autograph. And he told me recently he wouldn't go to China again because he'd just get too mobbed. So he was very famous abroad and perhaps a little less famous in our country.
What do you think it was about his work that so appealed to them? Because it is a very, as we were saying, it's a very specific eye on British culture.
Well, we're all culture, but as British people, with the British photographer, we are very revealed in it. And I think that's part of, he's so famous in France, because the French perhaps enjoy seeing us quite so revealed and exposed. So, yes.
Grayson, how did you and he meet? How did you become friends?
I was a big fan right from the 80s. The first time I saw his work, I was a huge fan. I saw it in some Sunday supplement or something. And I thought, oh, here's a fellow traveller. And then I was at an opening maybe 20 years ago, more so. And at an opening, had a few glasses of wine. I just went up to him and hugged him and said, I love you, Martin Parr. And we just stuck together that evening. I've become good friends. And my heart goes out to his wife, Susie, and his daughter, Ellen, because, you know, I was truly sad when I heard the news, because he was such fun. You know, we shared a love of comedy, and that was right the way through his work. And I think that's something that maybe one of the reasons he does struggle with some people to be taken seriously is because the comedy never wins the Oscar, and people who do things that are funny are often regarded as less than people who sort of play on the bias towards seriousness in culture.
Wendy, I know the loss is still very recent and very raw, and I'm always so grateful when friends of a person will speak so soon after a passing to really just help remind us about the person they were. And to be somebody's biographer is quite special, because you get to know probably more about a person than their close family members. You really get to inhabit them in quite a special way.
Well, in a sense, it's I held him in my consciousness for a year, 2 years really, and tried to find out everything about him. But mainly I talked to Martin, and we had 750,000 words of interviews and 50,000 photographs to put together to make Utterly Lazy and Inattentive. And the irony was, he wasn't utterly lazy. He was very hardworking, and he wasn't inattentive. He was more attentive than all of us in his perspicacity. The title comes from a school report when he was 15 by a teacher. The teacher was completely wrong. And Martin was a very gentle man, very mild-mannered, and very anonymous, in like a Marks and Spencer jumper. You'd miss him in a crowd, and that was on purpose. He was camouflaged. He was seeing us, and we weren't seeing him. And as Grayson just said, he was very funny and very hard-working and extremely generous. Through the Martin Parr Foundation, he has encouraged, supported British and Irish photographers and photographers coming to Britain. And I think British photography will be in a fantastic shape in 100 years' time, because now Martin has put in the work, the money, the support, the encouragement, the teaching. So I think we are extremely lucky to have him as a British photographer, cataloguing our world over 75 years, all of it, really, all the major events.
And Grayson, as an artist, it must be quite a special thing. And as Wendy was saying there, he was a humble man, but it must be a special thing to know that you have left your fingerprint on history in that sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, Martin is one of those rare artists that you see a scene, you see some lurid food or a queue or somebody wearing a funny outfit at ritual, and you just think, that looks like a Martin Parr photograph. And I think that is his legacy, is that he has framed a lot of images that we see every day in a certain way, with that wry, clever, tender, beautifully composed. He's seen the beauty in so many things that we see every single day.
Thank you so much, both of you, for it. I just think to hear about somebody's work, but also to hear about their life, to hear about them as a person. And you've both paid wonderful tribute. Thank you so much for being with us this morning, Wendy Jones and Grayson Perry. Thank you.
Thank you, Anna.
Now, we don't want to have a bias towards seriousness. So let's talk about Formula One, shall we? Here's Garthy with the sport.
This bit's fun. The next bit might not be quite so fun. Great Britain's Lando Norris has won his first Formula One World Championship.
Lando, this is Zach from McLaren. Is this the world champion hotline?
Yeah.
Good day.
Thanks.
Good day. Awesome.
Thank you, guys.
The McLaren driver secured third place that he needed in the season-ending Abu Dhabi Grand Prix to take the world Formula One title. Max Verstappen won that race, and we'll be speaking to the former world champion Damon Hill shortly. Not quite as successful, though. England's men lost the second test against Australia by 8 wickets to go 2-0 down in the 5-match Ashes series. We can speak to the former England captain, David Gower. David, where to start? England have never come from 2-0 down to beat Australia. Is there any chance this England side can change that?
Carter, yes, you're right. History says no. Ben Stokes will try his hardest to say yes. It's what they tried to do a couple of years ago back home in the UK with the last Ashes series, and rain apparently scuppered them. The problem is not so much history, I don't think, is the fact that they're underperforming. I mean, in this last game in Brisbane, they were outplayed pretty much every day. You can argue about the first day, but they were outplayed by Australia in every department. The intensity from the home side was better, was more obvious. And the mistakes have cost England dear, both in Perth in the first test match, you know, batting mistakes there, yeah. More batting mistakes in Brisbane, drop catches, add it all up, and they are way below par. So that's the thing that's going to be their biggest obstacle.
Yeah, you mentioned them underperforming, being below par. We heard the England captain, Ben Stokes, earlier in the programme saying, Australia is not for weak men. And he added, a dressing room that I am captain of is not a place for weak men either. What's the message Stokes is trying to portray with that?
Well, there's probably a slight difference between weak men and weak performances. Some of them in the middle order there have shown weaknesses. I mean, poor old Jamie Smith is yet to get going in this series, and yet we saw last summer against India the sort of talent he has. Australia can do that to people. I mean, some of the great players of all time have struggled down here. But it's the likes of, shall we say, Duckett, Pope, even Brooke. And I mean, Brooke is not a weak man, and he's a very, very talented player, but you can put it down to this: weak decisions at the wrong moment. And you know, in terms of the batting itself, some of those shots played, some of the decisions as to what to go for, what not to go for, you know, compared to the Australians who just batted and batted and batted. I mean, those are the differences. Each and every department, you can see differences.
You scored 5 centuries, I think it was 5, in Australia. England's batting, as you mentioned, has been such a problem. Is Baz Ball being blamed too much? Is it more than just that?
Well, yeah, I'm actually really sick and tired of people using that word.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it was coined, and it was great when it was coined, and it's all about freedom and positive batting and the rest of it. But look at the performances that actually worked in this test match in Brisbane. Joe Root, that was not Baz Ball. That was Joe Root playing test cricket as it should be played. Ben Stokes setting the example in the second innings, dogged as you like, hardly a shot played in anger. That is nothing to do with the way perceived Baz Ball. I think the perception has confused people. Yes, it's all about the freedom to express oneself and sort of building confidence in the dressing room. But let's face it, when you're having such a bad time as this, your confidence takes more than just a word. Your confidence comes from within. Going back to the weak men, you know, Ben Stokes and weak men. Somehow, someone has to build confidence in each and every one of those players. And that is a lot about personal responsibility. It's a lot about people looking in the mirror, deciding to make, shall we say, some changes to the way they play. Because, you know, for the last 3 years, people like me, others of my era, have looked at this, as it were, new era and said the one thing it needs to be is smarter. And I'm sorry, but there were signs in the summer against India that there were some smarts around. But in these first 2 test matches in Perth and Brisbane, you know, smart has not been there at all. Smart has been absent.
Yeah, well, I think a man that has won 2 Ashes series in Australia, as you are, David Gower, they should be taking note of what you're saying. And it will be interesting to speak to you further into this Ashes series. David Gower with the mood on the ground. Thank you very much, David. Just a couple of other headlines for you. Crystal Palace are up to 4th place in the Premier League after a 2-1 win over Fulham. Celtic lost 2-1 to Hearts in Wilfred Nancy's first game as the Celtic manager. And Mark Selby beat Judd Trump 10 frames to 8 to win his 3rd UK snooker championship title.
Thank you very much, Carthy. It is 25 to 9. Start the week on the way after 9 this morning. Tom Sutcliffe is here to tell us all. Morning, Tom.
Morning, Anna. Smart is not missing on Start the Week this morning. We've got winners too, enough to fill an Olympic podium. All of them gold medals. Lyndall Roper recently won the prestigious Kundal History Prize for Summer of Fire and Blood, her gripping account of the German Peasants' War. Hannah Durkin is this year's recipient of the Wolfson History Prize for her book about the survivors of the last known slave ship to dock in the USA. And Musad Hussein took this year's Royal Society Trivedi Prize for his book Our Brains, Ourselves, which draws on the patients he met during his work as a leading neurologist. So, fascinating human stories, all told with prize-winning flair on Start the Week, just after 9.
Can't wait.
Thank you, Tom.
Quick look at the weather now. Dry and bright with patchy cloud over parts of southern England and Wales. Showers over Scotland. Wet and windy towards the evening.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Nick Robinson and Anna Foster. And Caroline Nichols has a summary of the news.
President Zelensky will be welcomed to Downing Street by Sir Keir Starmer today for talks on the American proposal to end the war between Ukraine and Russia. They'll be joined by the French and German leaders as European powers seek to ensure that Kyiv receives security guarantees if a ceasefire is agreed. There have been days of negotiations between US and Ukrainian officials over a possible deal. Donald Trump's former ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, told us that Moscow would not stop unless Europe took the lead with its defence, increased its military spending and created what he called a roadblock for Russia. The head of the Royal Navy is expected to set out how the UK plans to tackle the threat from Russia to undersea cables and pipelines after increased activity by Russian ships during the past 2 years. The Prime Minister is to announce £725 million of funding to create 50,000 new apprenticeships in England. Some will be in sectors including AI, hospitality and engineering.
Thank you, Caroline. 23 minutes to 9 now. Lando Norris has won his first Formula One Drivers' Championship. He is the 11th British man to do it after securing third place in yesterday's Abu Dhabi Grand Prix. He saw off the challenge from Red Bull's Max Verstappen, who won the race, and of course his McLaren teammate Oscar Piastri. And there were, well, I think it's fair to say, one or two tears at the end.
Thank you, guys. Oh my God. You made a kid's dream come true. Thank you so much. I love you guys. Thanks for everything. You deserve it. I love you, Mum. I love you, Dad. Thanks for everything. I'm not crying. Oh, God. I've not cried in a while. I didn't think I would cry, but I did. It's a long journey. It's a long journey. First of all, I want to say a big thanks to my guys, everyone in McLaren. My parents, I'm not crying, my mum, my dad, you know, they're the ones who supported me since the beginning, so.
Oh, it's just lovely to hear that, isn't it? Well, Damon Hill is a former Formula One driver himself, of course, who knows what it's like to win the World Drivers' Championship. His came in 1996 with Williams. And Rob Dodds is Lando Norris's childhood karting coach. Morning, both of you.
Good morning, Anna.
Rob, to you first of all, I should say we're very comfortable with crying on this programme and listening to Lando there. I mean, you remember him when he was young, when he was just coming through. It must have been emotional for you yesterday as well.
Oh, definitely. I think he's still young.
Well, that's true, actually. He is, yeah.
Yeah. Yes, he came to me as a young seven-year-old, and along with his brother, who's Oliver, was a couple of years older. Amazing, really, to see how far the journey has gone in really what is a short space of time. You know, it's like 19 years, you know, which is crazy.
It really is. There's a question that we always ask at moments like this, but it's a question that we can't not ask, really, which is, did you know, when you saw him, did you think to yourself, this one's special?
Yeah, that's the favourite question.
It is.
Basically, how it worked, okay, so as I explained, he had an older brother, so they're both racing at the same time, so there was a bit of a sibling rivalry, which I think really pushed Lando on at an early age. There's no you've got to be 8 years old to race, and there's no 8 year olds out there winning. Lando was able to do that. So that was the That was a really important part, I think. You know, he had somebody to chase every time he went testing, etc. He was there racing his brother. So when it actually came to going on the big stage at the age of 8 years old, he was already competitive.
Yeah, the pieces were all in place. And actually, Damon Hill, that's a story that we often hear, particularly with F1, that it's young boys who got into it at such an early age, who knew that that was what they wanted to do and have really sort of stuck in over the years.
At this point, I have to say young girls also race.
I know they do. It's just F1 at the moment, which is why I keep saying men and boys. You're right, they're out there, but not in this.
It's open to anyone that wants to do it. And Lando had this dream. And as you say, he's followed it. It's a relatively short time. I remember meeting him when Zach had just signed him up, and he brought him to Spa, and I met this guy, this kid. He was like, I just looked at him and said, are you going to be big enough to, you know, to drive an F1 car? But he's filled out a bit now. And, but he's remained, totally open and the person that he wants to be. And I think he's getting a lot of praise for that. There was a time in the season where he maybe was a little bit too open and he was getting a little bit of punishment for some of the things he was saying, but he's recovered from that and finished the job. And it was very tempting to obviously use the famous Murray Walker quote, I've got to stop because I've got a lump in my throat. And it was very emotional to everyone seeing him getting out the car. He didn't take his helmet off for a very long time, and eventually he did. But he's let us all enjoy that moment with him by showing how much it means.
Yeah, and actually listening to that, it was really apparent. You say it's emotional for anybody to hear someone achieve something they've always wanted to achieve, and not many people know what that feels like, but you do.
Well, the thing is, I do, but it was a long time ago. So next year will be 30 years since I won the title. Oof. And he said something quite funny before in the press conference before the weekend, and saying that, you know, in 30 years' time, no one will care or something like that. So,
oh, we still
maybe
care.
In 30 years' time, he'll be on the Today programme being asked about another British driver to become world champion.
And that will be the pinnacle of achievement, no doubt. I mean, Rob, how far can he go, do you think? Are we talking, could he be one of the greats, multiple titles, a name that goes down in history?
Well, he's certainly got age on his side, hasn't he? And I think, once you've won the first one, hopefully the second one. I think in sport you get a taste for the winning, and I think he's still hungry.
He definitely is. It's been really lovely to talk to you both. Thank you so much, Rob Dodds, who's Lando Norris's childhood karting coach, and Damon Hill, of course, almost 30 years ago, the winner of his own World Drivers' Championship.
Yes, I'm sure Lando Norris might agree that appearing on the Today programme will be the pinnacle of his career.
It will be a highlight.
Give him time. He may come round to that view. It's now 17 minutes to 9.
I don't care if Monday's blue, Tuesday's grey and Wednesday too. Thursday, I don't care about you. It's Friday.
Medley of British songs there by British artists, but 2,000 figures from the music industry think that that might be under threat. They've signed a letter to the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, asking her to lower the business rates on recording studios. Now, at the moment, they are not entitled to the same sort of targeted relief as things like retail or hospitality or leisure sites get. And the letter says that that means that studios are now starting to close and British artists are having to move abroad to make their music instead. Well, Giles Martin joins us, Grammy-winning producer and composer and the son of the Beatles producer, George Martin. Giles, morning. Welcome to the programme.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Is this a real risk then? Studios are just struggling to afford the costs and they're having to close.
Well, it is a genuine risk. What is happening is that the government aren't seeing studios as a separate... I'm sorry. I've got a terrible repeat in my headphones.
I'm looking at our team, and they're going to try and sort that out. For the moment, if you try and just pop one of them off, it might make it slightly easier. Or when you finish answering, stick them back on again. You'll hear my next question.
Let me try this. Yeah, the main issue is that the government is putting a tax rebate on betting shops, hospitality, even film studios, but it's having recording studios exempt from any of these rebates or cuts. And studios are really the lifeblood of the music industry. They, obviously, without music being created in studios, there's no music to listen to. And the music industry is $8 billion a year. It's important the government recognises with their schemes of trying to help the arts that they give studios some kind of help, as about 50% of studios in the UK are thinking about closing right now.
And Giles, as a composer, as a producer, and particularly as George Martin's son, when we think of the Beatles, we think of Abbey Road, and these aren't just rooms where tracks are laid down. These are a really integral part of the whole process.
Well, that's true. I mean, I'm based at Abbey Road Studios, which isn't affected so badly because it's a large facility with a shop and tourists. But it's the smaller rooms. I mean, for instance, Harry Styles' album was recorded in our studios, a residential place which has three staff and costs £1,000 a day, and you can have 10 people staying there. Essentially, it's almost like an Airbnb. And his album creates huge amounts of work for apprentices, for people on tours, for a support, all of these kind of things. And it's not a huge amount of money for the government to lean into. I mean, the film industry, which is actually much, much bigger, they do this anyway.
Giles Martin, thank you for joining. Sorry about the technical problems you had. Giles Martin there talking about that letter, 2,000 figures from the music industry, hoping that there'll be a change on business rates on studios.
Just time to tell you what's coming up over on Radio 3, 110 years ago today. Interesting anniversary of that. But anyway, the Finnish government bestowed a singular honour on the composer Sibelius. They commissioned a symphony from him to mark his own 50th birthday and declared the day a national holiday for everyone. The resulting masterpiece is what Tom McKinney is about to play at 9 o'clock on Radio 3.
It's 12 minutes to nine now. Labour's flagship employment rights bill is back in the Commons today after going through amendments in the Lords. You will remember that the government had to row back on some elements of it to keep its passage going. One thing that was scrapped was protection for employees against unfair dismissal from the very first day of a new job. But there are plans instead to remove the cap on compensation for unfair dismissal claims. And that has divided unions and businesses. Let's discuss this with Richard Bergen, the Labour MP for Leeds East, and Helen Dickinson, who's the CEO of the British Retail Consortium. Good morning, both.
Morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Richard Bergen, I know that you were in support of day one protections for employees, and that had to go to smooth the passage of the bill. How do you feel? I presume you're in support of scrapping the cap on compensation.
I am, but I have to say it wasn't inevitable or necessary that the manifesto pledged to have day one rights in relation to unfair dismissal was scrapped. I know the government is saying that they couldn't get it past the Lords, but ultimately the government should have gone toe to toe with the Lords, had extra sittings, really pushed the Lords, because of course this Salisbury principle, if something's in a manifesto and a clear pledge that the unelected House of Lords has to relent, should have come into force. So I think really it's pressure from big business that's meant the government has unfortunately dropped, in a very positive bill, what was a central pledge, and that is that no worker should be allowed to be unfairly sacked. It should never be deemed okay for anybody, regardless of length of service, to be simply sacked unfairly. I think that's a policy that's very popular with the public, who were clearly elected upon it. And of course, I welcome the lifting of the cap on unfair dismissal compensation. But I think it's really disappointing that the government, I think under pressure from big business, has dropped this. And I do think that big business will scent blood and think that further down the line, because much of this legislation, much of the employment rights package will be determined by secondary legislation later.
Well, let's ask Helen Dickinson, who is the CEO, as we were saying, of the British Retail Consortium. Let's talk specifically about the cap, first of all, the scrapping of the cap on compensation, because that is the new detail here. How do your members feel about that?
Well, there are very few compensation claims that actually end up getting settled above the cap. But having spoken to some members at the end of last week, the concern is that the abolishing of it will give rise to just more claims and elongated processes, because there isn't that endpoint, that cap there to put a limit on what some of those claims look like. And given that there is a huge backlog in the tribunal system, around 60,000 claims, 20% up on last year. The worry is that, you know, if we get more claims coming through, that will just increase the backlog, and that will be bad for both, you know, employees and the fair settlement that they are seeking, as well as for employers. But I agree that the 6 month qualifying period is the most important aspect, and it's really important that the Parliament does vote that through today, because, you know, that came out of a process of engagement between unions, between government and business. And I think that's a really important concept that we should take through into the rest of the bill to make sure that the plans are all workable, practical, and don't have sort of unintended consequences on employment, particularly entry-level employment in lots of sectors like retail.
On that point, Richard Bergen, do you have any concerns that essentially unlimited cap on compensation for unfair dismissal could end up having a knock-on effect for other employees, for example, in a small business that might go bust as a result of having to pay that?
Well, before I was a member of Parliament, I was an employment lawyer for 10 years. And I know from that, and it's just been quoted, that the usual figures awarded for compensation, even in a successful unfair dismissal case, are far lower than the cap. The average compensation award is £7,000. So in reality, the cap, whilst welcome, will disproportionately favour the very highest earners. So it won't be applicable in practice to the majority of workers or the majority of employees. So I think whilst that's welcome as a move to lift the statutory cap on the compensation for unfair dismissal, I think it's really unwelcome that the government has dropped what was agreed with the British people, because it was in the manifesto clearly that we were elected upon, that workers would have unfair dismissal rights from day one, that it wouldn't be fine for bad bosses to unfairly sack workers regardless of their length, if they didn't have sufficient length of service.
And on that point, and I just on that point, Helen Dickinson, there is an inbuilt protection for businesses, isn't there, that this is about unfair dismissal, and if they're fair in their dealings, yes, then this is not something that which will affect them or impact them.
No, and I think, you know, I would agree. It's the whole purpose of the bill is to focus on the unscrupulous employer, to catch the bad guys, to lift the floor on poor employment practices. And what we've absolutely got to make sure that we're not doing is undermining the day-to-day practices of responsible businesses. And I think a 6 month qualifying period is perfectly reasonable for both the employer and the employee to test out each other, if you like, in the early days of employment, and work out whether or not that is something that is going to work for both parties. And so I think this is a real breakthrough in terms of, you know, engagement between employees, employee representative groups, the unions, between business and government, in trying to look at the practicalities, what's workable, and actually get the bill put through in a pragmatic way. And we need to see more of that as we go forward.
Okay. I mean, it is something that we will, of course, keep a close eye on this programme as that bill continues its progression through Parliament. Thanks for joining us, Helen Dickinson, who's the CEO of the British Retail Consortium, and Richard Bergen, who's the Labour MP for Leeds East.
It is now 529. The remnants of a language spoken in parts of the UK and Ireland 2,000 years ago are being collected for what is being billed as the first complete dictionary of ancient Celtic. It's been written by academics at Aberystwyth University. Joining us from there, the senior lecturer at the Department of Welsh and Celtic Studies, who's leading the project, Simon Rodway. Good morning to you, Mr. Rodway.
Good morning.
This sounds like an exciting day for linguists, but before we get on to why you're excited, what do people just listening, wherever they are in the country, what connection do they have with these ancient languages?
Well, I mean, I think the thing is that the Celtic languages are the first languages which are directly attested that were spoken in Britain and Ireland. You know, when the Romans, when Julius Caesar arrived in Britain in the first century BC, you know, he recorded names of people and places and so on, which are recognisably Celtic. So, and that's the direct ancestor, well, at least as close to the direct ancestor of languages like Welsh and Scottish Gaelic that are spoken today. Of course, there must have been languages spoken before that, but we don't know anything about them because there is no documentation. So this takes us back to the earliest point that we can actually say anything about in the linguistic history of these islands.
But if we look at place names in particular, I read that Morecambe, for example, gives a connection with the Celtic language. Aberystwyth is another.
Yes, that's right. I mean, of course, there are lots of place names in Wales that are in a Celtic language, Welsh, you know, but some of them are quite ancient. And you're right, Aberystwyth is one, or at least the name of the Ystwyth, which is the river which where Aberystwyth is at the mouth of the Ystwyth. And that was recorded by Ptolemy in the middle of the 2nd century AD as Stuctia.
So Aber yes. is simply mouth, Ystwyth is the other.
That's
part.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
And what about Morecambe?
That's absolutely
then?
Right. Morecambe, this contains... well, it's recorded by Ptolemy as Morecambe. So those are two Celtic words. Mori is the word for sea, which we still see in Welsh as mor, and also Old Irish mur is the same word. And then Cambe is, you've still got that in Welsh and in Irish, as cam, crooked. So so it shows that even in parts of Britain that have been English-speaking for centuries, at one point there were Celtic languages spoken there as well.
So in order to draw up this dictionary to compare these different Celtic languages, you're what, forced to go for where there is documentation, particularly Roman documentation, or remnants of the language in place names or personal names, are you?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, there are lots of gaps at this stage, particularly in Ireland. We don't really have any data before the middle of the 2nd century. Ireland was never part of the Roman Empire, so literacy arrived there quite late and so on. Roman Britain, we've got quite a lot, but it's almost all written in Latin, but it contains some individual words, and it also contains place names and personal names and so on that we can identify as being Celtic, and they can tell us something about the Celtic language that was spoken there alongside Latin. And we also have, excitingly, we've got a very few inscriptions in Celtic languages, some from Roman Bath, some that have recently been published from Uli that are cursed tablets written in Celtic. So they're really exciting. And then later on, we've got inscriptions from Ireland in what's called the Oum alphabet, which was an interesting alphabet used in the sort of, well, up until the early medieval period in Ireland.
Well, we have learnt a lot. We don't need in our time for that. We done it here on the Today programme this morning. Dr. Simon Rodway, good luck with the dictionary. Senior lecturer there in the Department of Welsh and Celtic Studies at Aberystwyth University.
Last quick headline for you before we go. Nick was interviewing, as you remember, Gordon Sondland earlier in the programme, Donald Trump's former ambassador to the EU, on the new US national security strategy, which is sharply critical of Europe. Now, in the last couple of minutes, the EU chief Antonio Costa has been speaking.